You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 490 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're coming to you in separate locations this week. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the AL West champion, Mariners.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks.
Alas, no longer number one in DVOA, despite a comfortable victory on Sunday over the Tennessee
Titans. The Rams
jumped
them. I mean, that victory they had, I'm not surprised.
The Rams are mean. They are a mean team. It turns out that that losing to the Rams by 2 points at SoFi Stadium might not have been such an embarrassing result, but we'll get to that
whoever
later.
Said it was embarrassing. Literally,
I know it said
no
it was embarrassing.
Said it was embarrassing, first off.
I know. I'm exaggerating for effect.
Second off, they lost by 2 points to the Rams, and they should have won that game, and I still am holding on to this.
Okay, well, continue holding on to that. We'll talk more about that later in the podcast. I don't think we need to do emergency style the weekend that was in Seattle football, because it was like, we'll talk about the Seahawks game got fake close at the end. We'll talk about how it was fake close, but like, it was about the least stressful weekend of football viewing in November that I can possibly remember. Like, it happens sometimes in September when the Huskies are in non-conference play, but just like, comfortable victories all around. It was great times.
Yep. That's
so
fine.
Let's
I'm fine.
Let's start with what was some tense viewing on Sunday, and that was UW soccer. Women's soccer's run in tribute to the late Mia Hamm continues. On Thursday, they reached the Sweet 16 at the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2020 with an overtime victory against number 5 seed Arkansas. That game was scoreless through regulation before the Huskies' Alex Buck scored a golazo from outside the box all alone on the break, 8 minutes into the extra session, making a great move to create separation for a shot and scoring her third goal of the NCAA tournament. The golden goal format gave the Huskies the immediate victory. Did you see the video of the UW football team watching this in the media room?
Yeah, no, that was
just
awesome.
Outstanding stuff. One of my favorite things about athletic departments is all the teams coming together to support each other. Then on Sunday, opposite the Husky, the Seahawks, I should say, against host Virginia, the Huskies took an early lead through Kayla Eichenberger in the 13th minute, but Kalea Eichenberger, I should say, in the 13th minute, but saw Virginia equalize just after halftime amidst heavy pressure. They then went down a player when Eichenberger was sent off via VAR in the late stages of regulation for throwing an elbow. In overtime, VAR confirmed a ruling that the Cavaliers did not score on a shot that hit the crossbar, went basically straight down, did not go all the way over the line. Virginia then had a second shot off the crossbar in the second overtime, but that went no score, and we went to penalties, where Tanner Ijams saved the opening Virginia penalty, and the Huskies went 5 for 5 from the spot to reach the Elite Eight for the third time in program history, in the first since 2010. Huskies now will stay on the East Coast, presumably head to Durham to face Duke on Friday at 1 p.m. for a spot in the College Cup, the Final Four.
What TV is that on?
I believe that is also on ESPN Plus, but let me double check that because I did not put that in the notes. So Sunday, a big day for soccer at UW in general, as we also had men's soccer in action. Yeah, that is on ESPN
Plus. We're a soccer school. That's it.
We are a soccer school for the moment. The men played Thursday at Corvallis, beat Oregon State 3-2 with Richie
Amon. That's right.
Amon scoring the golden goal in the 104th minute of second overtime. The Huskies equalized twice after trailing in that game, including Connor Lofi in the 85th minute, with time running out on their chances to force overtime. Then Sunday, you
have fun in the Pac-12, suckers.
You know, men went to SMU, and Lofi had the only goal in the 72nd minute as the Huskies outshot the Mustangs 17-8, allowing just one shot on goal and advancing to the Sweet 16 to face Stanford in Palo Alto on Sunday. What's the time on that one? Let me double check, because I also did not get that in the notes. But awesome to see both soccer programs coming through like this, and the women now one win away from an improbable Final Four spot. That'll be 5 p.m. at Stanford on Sunday for the UW men. I believe also on ESPN Plus. All right, additional toast this week. Congrats to Jackson Smith and Jigba, who broke DK Metcalf's single season receiving record in the third quarter on Sunday with six, count them, six games left in the Seahawks schedule. This historic season for JSN continues, much to your dismay in fantasy as you were going against him.
I won both games.
Okay, not to your
But
dismay.
the thing that is shocking to me is I pulled up odds for Offensive Player of the Year, which granted, this should be a conversation about MVP, but that's fine. How is Jonathan Taylor still favored over JSN for Offensive Player of the Year? I mean, the money is close. It's minus 140 for Jonathan Taylor, plus 105 for JSN. But like in a big game, Jonathan Taylor, right? The most important game that they've played all year, and they'll have a chance, these two teams, in a couple of weeks to settle it once and for all. Jonathan Taylor just wasn't a factor. 16 carries for 58 yards, two receptions for 8 yards. Like, if there is a player who can just be completely taken out of the game, like Jonathan Taylor was against the Chiefs, they cannot be Offensive Player of the Year. And meanwhile, JSN has been huge in every single game this season.
What's his lowest receiving yardage output in a game? Probably the Arizona game, the first Arizona
He
game.
had, yeah, 79 at Arizona, but
Including like monster catches in the second half of a close game.
so far, the most important game of the year has been that at Rams game, and it's 9 receptions for 105 yards in that one, and a carry for 11 yards as well. It's just like these are not even close, these numbers, and not to mention that a wide receiver is just more valuable than a running back in that perspective also. But like
And
last
also,
week, he goes for 167 yards. He's breaking records by week 11.
just in terms of like you've seen the charts of yards per route run, yards per game, and like he's off the charts. Jonathan Taylor's having a nice season and certainly, scoring a lot, which is, the reason he's favored for this award, the number of touchdowns he has. But, there are other running backs within striking distance of Jonathan Taylor in a way that no receiver is of JSN.
He's having a good season, right? Like, I mean, the
Like James
244
Cook has
yards against the.
103 fewer yards than him on the ground.
Yeah. He's having a good season, and JSN is having like an all-time season, is having one of the best receivers of all time so far.
There you go.
Yeah, no, the difference between the closest receiver to JSN is bonkers.
It's
And for Jonathan
mind-boggling.
Taylor, it's like there's a bunch of guys right there.
Lastly, congrats to the Reigns keeper Claudia Dickey and defender Jordan Bugg, both named to the NWSL's second 11 as the league wrapped up its season with Gotham FC, three ex-Reign players in their starting 11 for the championship as they won for a second time in the past 3 years here. So that was a little bit tough to see on I think that was Saturday night. All right, Seattle Mariners talk. Do
Do we have any?
we have a little bit. The Mariners set May 2nd is the date for Randy Johnson's jersey retirement. So save that date for low those 5 months from now. They also announced that they non-tendered relievers Gregory Santos and Trent Thornton prior to the deadline for 2026. Thornton probably to be expected after an Achilles rupture that will likely sideline him to start and presumably well into 2026. Santos may be a bit more surprising. He had knee surgery in April, pitched in Tacoma in September, but never returned to the major league roster. And looks like Mariners have been loading up on a variety of relievers, whether minor leaguers or, minor free agents, and definitely seems like they've just decided the Gregory Santos experiment has run its course. It was,
I'm
looked
a
like a
little
reasonable bet.
surprised. I mean, Trent Thornton with the injury stuff, but like, I think Trent Thornton, I feel like he's going to be back with the team. He definitely
Wouldn't
was somebody
surprise
who's.
me. Yeah, if he just signs a minor league contract with the Mariners.
He was right there at the center when they were celebrating their AL West win. But like, just knowing that you need to have a lot of receivers around, I don't know what the number is to tender Gregory Santos, but can't be that much, right?
Well, I think it's more the 40-man roster spot that's the concern for them.
Okay, fair enough.
So, Besides Josh Naylor, not a lot happening in free agency at the moment.
I mean, there's some transact happening for other teams, but even that's pretty mild. All
Right, into the roundup. Seattle Kraken, a strong road trip at a 3-2 win at Chicago on Thursday, 3-2 overtime win at Pittsburgh, and then a shootout loss after a scoreless game Sunday against the New York Islanders. They're currently tied for second in the Pacific and fourth in the West. And yet, every week I check the underlying stats, like, hey, maybe this is the week that the Kraken have actually moved up in Corsi and Fenwick, or all of these, advanced stats that tend to be better predictor of success going forward in the NHL. And nope, they remain among the handful of very worst teams in the NHL by all the advanced metrics. It is kind of bizarre how they are outperforming them. They'll be back home Thanksgiving Eve against Dallas, Saturday against Edmonton. One thing I noticed looking through Hockey Reference to find those advanced stats, short-lived Kraken center Morgan Geekie leads the NHL with 17 goals for the Boston Bruins. He's tied for the lead. So
Really?
did not realize they had a big-time goal scorer on the roster and let him get away. All right, some Seattle news, Rain news. They announced a one-year contract extension for Jess Fishlock, now the last of the Rain's OGs, with the retirement of Lou Barnes and Megan Rapinoe's jersey already in the rafters. But Fishlock, even though she is nearing the end of her career, and this could be her final year in NWSL in 2026, still remains a really crucial part of this Rain attack. She led the team, tied with Emery Adames with 6 goals this season, had a pair of assists, so tied with Maddie Delin in terms of goals plus assists contributed. And, this despite the fact that her minutes are obviously limited at this stage of her career. She's age 38, will be 39 in January ahead of the upcoming NWSL season. But exciting to see. Jess Fishlock has been a part of every Seattle Reign season to date, and will remain so in 2026. All right, Seattle Storm, WNBA draft lottery was on Sunday, and it ended up going completely chalk. The Dallas Wings land the number one pick. They had
So
the best
strange.
odds of it. The Minnesota Lynx, number two, which is where they were, and then Storm end up drawn at number three, which I'd say it's probably not a bad outcome for them, all things considered. AwoFam, as we talked about last week, continues to be seen. There's certainly a lot of question marks. I don't think there's one clear star prospect. I mean, there's definitely not one year clear star prospect in this year's draft, but obviously there's not a Caitlin Carker or Paige Bueckers. There just may not even be a Ryan Howard, let's say, who was the number one pick of the draft before Caitlin Clark. I don't think in this year's draft. And there's going to be uncertainty about who that pick is, maybe all the way through the spring here, is teams are going to scout these players in college and then AwoFam competing in the EuroLeague.
So
But
I guess my question to you is, do you feel comfortable and confident saying that right now? Like, do we have enough information to actually say there's not that player, the third best player or whatever, the consensus first, second, and third best player at this point, because there's still so much season to happen.
exactly. And so one of the interesting things that happens with Dallas getting the number one pick, is he FUD? Is it a relationship with Paige Bueckers? We'll be interested to see whether that's a factor, if the Wings want to reunite those two UConn stars, how that plays out. I don't think AwoFam gets below two. To me, if she's out there for Minnesota, she's an easy choice. They've needed more, kind of size in the paint, have tried a variety of options to get that, and to
But that's
have a
fine
player
for the
with her
Storm, right?
potential. I think so. Yeah. I mean, I think they would draft AwoFam if they were in position to draft her and felt like she was the best prospect. I don't think Dominique Malunga would prevent them from doing it, but I also don't think they're like terribly upset if she goes ahead of them either. So I would say, if I had to guess right now, I think AwoFam and AZ FUD go 1-2 in some order. And my bet then for the Storm would be Flauge Johnson. But certainly
How do we
could be
feel about
Olivia
Flauge
Miles.
Johnson?
I mean, the athletic potential is there, the skill is there, could stand to improve, is a shooter, certainly. But I think someone like getting athletic wings with size is, a really difficult thing in the WNBA. The Storm, do have one of those in Gabby Williams, who's a free agent, but represented them at the lottery, an encouraging sign that she intends to be back in 2026. If you had her and Flauge Johnson on the wing, I'd feel pretty good about that. I mean, it's not, again, the ideal shooting that maybe you'd want in that spot, but you wouldn't lose anything defensively. I mean, Olivia Miles is certainly in the mix.
Why
We'll
did
see how
Olivia
teams
Miles
feel about
transfer?
Lauren Betts. That's a more complex issue than we can get into in this podcast. But some locker room issues at Notre Dame last year,
Okay,
suffice it
fair
to
enough.
say.
All right. didn't realize what I was
Not,
stepping into there.
nothing that I think illustrates a concern about Olivia Miles in the WNBA, but the question mark with her, I think, is going to be just what you think, how capable you think she's going to be defensively at the WNBA level, because she's not that kind of athlete.
Okay, who is your preference?
I'd be excited to see Flauge. I think it'd be fun.
I mean, I think it's pretty cool that, like, even at the base level, this is the good thing that the WNBA and women's college basketball have going for it, is that to be able to watch, like, these are names that I know, right? And
Exactly.
obviously, Olivia Miles is coming into the league much older than a lot of players are to the NBA or even maybe even the NFL in a lot of situations. But she's just played so many games that the expectation, I think, should be that she comes in and is a factor pretty much immediately, right? If this is a Storm team that's going to compete for a playoff spot.
And this is one of those things that Talisa Rhea mentioned when I spoke to her, the Storm's GM, after the lottery, that we feel really good with the depth of this draft, that we're going to get someone who's going to help us right away. Miles, one of the things we were tracking last year when we thought the Storm might take her at number two, part of the reason she bumped up to kind of that exalted point in the draft before we knew just how good Dominique Malunga was going to be, is she shot 41% on threes. This year, she's back down to 30%, 32% for her career. And if she's not that kind of shooter, then you don't feel as strongly about her potential. But she is shooting a career high 59% on twos, averaging 18.3 points per game. And her steal rate, intriguingly, now that she's not playing with Hannah Hidalgo, who is stealing everything at Notre Dame, has almost doubled from last season. So, certainly a lot to consider there with her as well. And
I'm also the, well,
Lauren Betts
just.
might be the best player in college basketball. I think she is a harder fit with Malunga than even AlFam would have been, because both of them are a little more athletic.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, what you're talking about with Olivia Miles is six games.
That's
So
true.
it's six games against Rio Grande Valley and Tarleton State and stuff like that. Like, there's been one, they played at NC State and she shot 4 of 18. So. There's just so much more to the picture to be painted. And I think that's why for me, it's a little bit hard. Like we can watch these players and get excited about them, but to be like, this is who the third best player is going to be this year. Oh,
Of
fam,
course.
like the things might not change as much, but there's a whole college basketball season to be played. And I think things are going to transform during it.
Without question, it's fun to just have, a reason to be interested at the top, even, not coming off of a lottery season. So.
So I guess before they've made this pick, we're talking process-wise for the Storm. Looking back, this has been a 3-year process, basically, of getting to this point. Do you feel like they have made the right moves along the way to be in the best position long term? Without cherry picking, like, oh, they could have drafted whatever. I don't know if that even happens as much. Like in the NFL, it's like, oh, they could
I
have
mean,
drafted Tom Brady. You know what I mean?
are
Like,
you not remembering our discussions about the Storm traded the pick that could have been Angel Reese that happened
I
on
mean,
this podcast in
no,
2024?
that is a legit thing, though. I'm saying you can't just like when people are like, oh, this
Oh.
team passed on whatever, like all the teams who passed on Jokic or something. Like, of course, if you could have, had a crystal ball, like you could have changed things. But for the Angel Reese is a legit conversation because that is probably who the pick may have been had the Storm selected there.
I mean, she did fall all the way to seventh. I don't know that it would have been, but it was not unreasonable to expect that they would have. It's not like Angel Reese came out of nowhere. She was the most outstanding player of the Final Four 2 years before or during her junior season. I mean, I think what's interesting is, that conversation really centered her on, did they give up too much to go after this veteran team to be able to sign both Skylar Diggins and Nneka Ogwumike? Because they had the number four pick. They trade that to LA to clear the cap space to sign those players. And what they get in return is this 2026 pick from LA. and they end up picking higher in the draft than they would have otherwise. I don't think this is nearly as strong a draft as 2023. So I do think you can make a case in pure value terms that they downgraded from the number four pick, who ended up being Rickea Jackson, to this pick.
How has
But
Rickea Jackson been, by the way?
well, she destroys the Storm. She's kind of like the player who is the most eye test player in the WNBA, I would say. Like, the advanced numbers never like her because she does not get any steals and, shoots a relatively low percentage, but makes tremendous difficult shots, and again has destroyed the Storm head to head as if it's personal. So I would rather have the number three pick in the cap space than Rickea Jackson. I would probably at this point even rather have it than Angel Reese, but that's a more difficult question, certainly. I mean, the one thing you would look back on is obviously if they could do it over, they would not have made that trade that they did at the deadline. Brittany Sykes didn't have the impact that they were hoping, after she came over from Washington. And by trading their own pick instead of Vegas's, they end up giving up the number nine pick in next year's draft instead of the number 14.
Okay, but it's not a huge deal at that point.
No,
The
no.
ninth to 14th pick, moving up from 4 to 3. I think it is the relative strength of the drafts. I just think that's a little bit hard to judge. And like the player that they end up with, will they be as good as Rickea Jackson? The answer is probably yes. And then now you have a player to pair with Dom Malunga. And you also, now that you have Malunga, you have a better understanding of what the organization is going to look like rather than kind of piecemealing it together. You have a vision and a plan.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing is Dom. Like, having a centerpiece and then, being able to fit some other young talent around her. You've got Jordan Hairston coming back this season from her ACL tear. You've got this number three pick. You've got the 14th pick in this year's draft. There's a young core in place that allows a bit of a two timetable approach, as we've talked about. And we'll see, kind of depending on free agency, how heavy the timetable remains on win now as opposed to looking into the future. Because I mean, one of the things that is a possibility is if you do think you're going to take Olivia Miles here and you don't bring back Skylar Diggins and you think you're going to get much younger at point guard, that's going to kind of change some things. So we'll see. Many variables, including the WNBA CBA, that extension was through November 30th. We're 5 days away. Not seemingly a lot of progress based on the reporting by my ESPN colleague Alexa Philippou towards a deal, but decide to continue meeting. So stay tuned.
I do not think the WNBA should not lock out or strike.
Well, even if the CBA expired, it wouldn't necessarily cause that. Whether there actually needs to be an extension, it's kind of more symbolic more than anything else.
Okay.
So,
All right. Well, I think things have
well,
generally worked out for the Storm. I also was thinking that they should, we as fans should enjoy this time period when it's much easier to draft. To select at the top of the draft because that is going to change over time.
yes, with all these teams coming into the league, the lottery is probably going to have to get overhauled at some point.
The types of players that we're going to be paying, like you were talking about, like the Olivia Miles and players like that, it's like paying attention to the biggest names in all of college basketball. And 5 years from now, like we're in the golden age as it is. And
And
for the
they've gotten to
Storm, they're
do it.
definitely in
I
the golden age.
mean, obviously, they gave up again the lottery pick that they did earn by being bad in 23, but they had the number two pick last year. They have the three pick this year. They've been in the mix without having to sacrifice being a competitive team, which is how you'd like to do it. Shouts to the Atlanta Hawks. Figured up women's basketball, which re has reached 5-0, moved up to number 22 in the AP poll, ranked now at number 23 in the coaches poll. On Wednesday, they beat Fresno State 61-43. Sellers had 14 points, as did Avery Howell in that win, while the bench totaled 23 points, despite being outscored 14-7 in the final period to make the final score more respectable. Then Sunday, the Huskies beat a decent Vermont team 71-39. They held the Catamounts to 29% shooting. You got 22 points from Sellers, 20 off the bench from Bryn McGahee in the best performance of her young career. Elledine was upgraded to questionable on Sunday, but missed her fifth consecutive game. We'll see if we see her back. Tuesday night, the Huskies will face Southern. Friday, UC San Diego. Monday, San Jose State during this homestand against mid-major competition. UC San Diego is the best of those three opponents by Bart Torvik's rankings. The Tritons are coached by former Storm assistant coach Heidi Vandervoor and won the Big West last year, off to a 2-3 start this year. Southern 1-4, having beat NAIA foe Tougaloo at home. They lost their other four games on the road to top 20 opponents by an average of 40 plus points per game. San Jose State, winless thus far, having lost to lowly Pepperdine by 24 on Sunday. So we should be talking next week about an 8-0 UW women's basketball team heading into their Big Ten opener against USC, which would be an intriguing matchup, to say the least. UW men's basketball was off after their scare against Southern last Tuesday, and now it's here. What we've all been waiting for. The Acrisure Holiday Classic.
Hello. Been
A
waiting a
tradition
year for
unlike
this.
any other. And the Huskies start against a familiar opponent in Nevada. They swept a home-and-home series the last 2 years, but Nevada not as strong this year under Steve Alford. They're off to a 4-2 start, lost their only game against a top 100 opponent at Santa Clara, 98-83, then also lost at home to lowly UC Davis, dropping as low as 116 in the KenPom rankings before moving up 7 spots by comfortably beating UC Santa Barbara. They're led by UTEP transfer Corey Camper, who's averaging 16.8 points per game. Wolfpack pretty good on the glass, outstanding getting to the line, which could be a concern if the Huskies are still shorthanded and getting foul trouble. Hopefully they'll be healthier after this 9-day break, although I believe I saw that they had an injury to Lathan in practice as well. So that's a little disconcerting given how limited their numbers were. Yeah, that Lathan Somerville had an ankle injury in practice over the weekend. So we'll see what his status is. There's obviously not a lot of information out there about that in men's basketball until everybody gets to Palm Desert for the Acrisure Holiday Classic. Huskies are the KenPom favorite to win the tournament. On the other side of the bracket, San Francisco is favored over our old friend Colorado. The Dons are 5-1 with their lone loss at Memphis. Well, Colorado 5-0, but has faced just one top 190 team in KenPom, beating Providence at home.
So is UW going to repeat as the Acrisure Invitational Classic winner?
I mean, I would never guarantee that, but again, they should be the betting favorites in this one.
Guaranteed here on the fabulous Pelton cast. ESPN senior writer Kevin Pelton says Huskies a lock to win the Acrisure Invitational.
Holiday Classic, this case. There's a
Acrisure
bunch of
Holiday
different
Classic.
Acrisure tournaments. That's the one they're in. Last year, I think they were in the Acrisure Invitational. I mean, also, we got to see what the health is. Hopefully, Hannes Stein back
What
and
time is the
playing
game
in
on
this.
Thursday? The Thanksgiving game?
It is Thursday night at. Oh, no, it is not Thursday night. I'm sorry. It's at Thursday afternoon, 1:30 p.m.,
Wow.
CBS Sports Network.
I am so happy we get to watch the Acrisure Holiday Classic together. An experience unlike any other.
An experience we did not get last year when we were separated for the Acrisure
Ugh,
Invitational.
devastating.
What is Acrisure?
I don't know. No one knows. I don't want to look
It's
it up because I don't want to give them that kind of respect, but
right, UW football reached 8-3 on Saturday with a 48-14 win at UCLA. People were scared of this game.
who are
They
people? Are you people?
I'm not people, no. I was confident about
Okay. What did I give? 100%.
it. People were concerned about the Huskies on the road at the Rose Bowl because of the fact that they lost there under like Sark or something. I don't know, man. Like, there's a causal explanation for why it would be difficult for them to play at Wisconsin or even Arizona and Arizona State. Like, climate-wise, those are often difficult games. UCLA in front of a half-empty Rose Bowl, nah. Not that. And unfortunately, Nico Iamaleava, it kind of frankly seemed based on, having to leave the game again with an apparent head injury and his performance before he did go out, that I'm not sure he should have been out there after missing their previous game against Ohio State with a concussion. I mean, look, we're not doctors, but definitely did not seem 100% in that one.
I don't necessarily, I don't want to take anything away from UW's performance based upon that, because there wasn't anything like, I mean, as a human being, yes, sure, but like the UW performance is all we could specifically talk about, right? And I don't think that I don't think they played any better because of any other reason. I think
I mean,
they just played very good defense in this game.
it was sound. What really stood out, I think, was the open field tackling because everything was underneath for UCLA. There was nothing, never any attempt. It's funny because I think on the broadcast they mentioned that talking to Tim Skipper, the UCLA interim coach, that he was like, "Well, we feel really good about the matchups with our wide receivers against UW's defensive backs, who were without Tecario Davis in this one, an injury that kind of popped up late and hopefully will not affect him against Oregon this weekend." And they didn't actually test them deep, but the throws that they did complete underneath, the Huskies were rallying quickly to the football and they were tackling well and they were not giving up any extra yardage that would have potentially allowed the Bruins to move the ball more comfortably.
Oh no, I mean, I think Nico in general is also a little bit of a cautionary tale in college football playoff era or transfer portal era. People have these conversations where they're like, Carson Beck is making more than whatever starting NFL quarterback. And I'm just like, for every college football conversation that you have about a quarterback, the answer is be careful because life can come at you very, very fast with regards to college football quarterbacking and what it can mean for the rest of your career. So this idea that it's basically like, oh, quarterbacks are going to stay in college and it's going to always be perfect every year. Things can change very, very quickly between programs and between seasons. Anyway, I thought this was the best defensive performance of the year that the Huskies had, and they've turned in a couple of very good ones lately. I mean, like, there
I'd
really
say
hasn't.
three in a row,
I don't
and
know
maybe
if there's
four going
been.
back to Illinois.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, even the Michigan game, they got a little bit overpowered by the end. But like 417 yards to Michigan on the road and being put in such a bad situation by the interceptions, I think this UW defense might be good, dare
I
I
mean,
say.
over the course of the season, they ranked now 30th in FPI efficiency. That's up 15 spots from where they were last year, and up at least, multiple, double digit spots from where they were just a few weeks ago in the stat.
I mean, I think Ryan Walters has had a pretty brilliant performance with this UW defense. Obviously, there's a lot more skill on it, but it's happening with young players as well. It's not just transfers.
I would say it's obvious that there's a lot more skill. What I would say is obvious is that there's a lot more, size to combat traditional Big Ten opponents, which UCLA is not particularly.
But I do think the tackling, and that's, an important conversation when we talk about Oregon, the tackling on the edge is huge. Right? Having safeties who can tackle, having corners who can tackle, and Ephesians and Takario as those two corners who can do that, but also some of the depth that they have in the secondary as well, and getting the impact from the young players along the way. Like,
Rashawn
I.
Clarke, I think, had a really strong game in terms of tackling on Saturday in the nickel spot.
The Dylan Robinson fumble that he forced, I thought that was awesome. Like,
Dylan Robinson is going to be good. There's no question about it.
in general, seeing and the defensive line coming on, the defensive line was kind of the weak point of the Huskies overall. But the way that they've played these last handful of weeks, they had actual pressure against UCLA in that game. They were getting to Nico a little bit more than I feel like they have otherwise for a lot of these quarterbacks. So
I mean, we saw
I'm.
Jacob Manu in this one for the last time during the regular season. It was funny. They were really playing that up in the broadcast. It's like, we won't see him again in the regular season. It's like, well, there's only 1 week left. We weren't going to see him that much in the regular season either way. The bowl game is two games away. But he will sit out Saturday to preserve his red shirt, but wanted to play at home. The Santa Ana native wanted to play at home against UCLA and made a difference in this one.
And then just beyond that, having that kind of performance, dropping 48 against UCLA. And again, I think people are like, well, it's UCLA. And there's a reality that they don't give up this many points that often, right? It's not like every single week. Other teams play UCLA and it's on the schedule. They gave up 48 to Ohio State, they gave up 55 to Indiana. That's it. It was 43 against Utah, but like the teams that you're talking about who score that many points against them are the best teams in the country. I mean, those are three top 10 teams, Utah, Indiana, and Ohio State, who've scored that many points. So it's not like every single team comes in. I mean, they hosted Nebraska and beat them, right? And they only gave up 21, or no, they hosted Nebraska, they lost Nebraska, but they only gave up 28 points to Nebraska. Like, it is a difference between these teams. And for UW to have done that without Denzel Boston, without Jonah Coleman for the most part, They schemed it, and it is a deep offense as well. It's not just Damon Williams, and it's not just Jonah Coleman. It's not just Denzel Boston. Like, the impact that they got Roebuck in the second half, he had a quiet first half, and then Desmond Roebuck really coming on. And what they're developing with Chris Lawson and Audric Harris drew the pass interference penalty, I believe. They're definitely building a more diverse and robust offense than just kind of their star players.
I
And
mean, I think
Jordan
it all centers.
Washington too. I mean, like, good God.
He's just out of a cannon every time that he gets the ball in the backfield. I mean, Adam Mohamed, first career 100-yard game, 21 carries, 108 yards. They got him there. That was clearly a focus on the final drive. He was in there even after Damon Williams Jr. got pulled. I mean, I think everything still starts with Damon, but yeah, the ability to run the ball effectively, the depth. So Denzel Boston did not get targeted. He played a little bit in situations around the goal line. Jonah Coleman got four carries all consecutively in an attempt to get him a touchdown. He remains tied for the Big Ten lead after getting it on fourth down
And
after those
did
four
you see
consecutive carries.
his quote about that also?
No.
He was like, it was all about getting Jonah a touchdown.
Oh,
Touchdowns are fun. We
Jed
wanted to
Fish's
reward him.
comment. Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. I thought you meant Jonas. Yeah,
No.
yeah.
But and that's one of my favorite things about Jed is basically there's so many like old football coach mentalities where they're just like, sit down, shut up, listen to what I tell you, fall in line. And
Or
that is
I always think of
not.
the Denzel Washington, football's still fun anymore? Zero fun, sir. Like, no, that actually shouldn't be the
He literally said the exact opposite. Touchdowns are fun.
case. It should be fun.
And that is one of my favorite things about Jed is that he's willing to reward players for what they've done. And it's like, if you want to go keep scoring, fuck it. We'll go keep scoring. Sometimes to the detriment of the team, he's willing to do that. But like there is a it is a way of speaking to the players, basically, by showing that you're doing this. Even as much as fans might want to be like, stop, 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 stop. Jonah Coleman wanted to score a touchdown. You know, he was excited about getting those four carries and scoring that touchdown in LA. And I think it's an important deal when you're going and having those conversations with your current players and with other hypothetical players that you are do stuff like that and be able to. So I think Jed's done a great job.
I mean, I do will say that the one thing is like the Huskies playing as well as they did the last 2 weeks. It just I mean, Wisconsin's good, not I mean not good, but that loss no longer looks as bad as it did. I would say it's clear that Wisconsin, after they sort of, were able to right the ship midseason, is a competitive team. They got their second conference when they blew out Illinois 27-10 at home on Saturday. So again, that loss doesn't look as
I
bad,
now have a
but
personal vendetta against Luke Altmyer too, just for being an
I
asshole here. So I love seeing, like, of all people who I'm just like, yeah, fuck that guy. It's Luke Altmyer of all people. That's what I've taken away. I have no animosity to Ohio State. I left that game. I wasn't like, God, I hate Julian Zane. Even their fans, I was like, I got nothing. I have no emotions about Ohio State, but Luke Altmyer can go to hell. And so seeing him get roughed up by Wisconsin, I was like, let's freaking go.
Luke Altmyer in that one, 21 of 35 for 248 yards. I mean, he was fine. Where did their turnover? Did they have any turnovers? I guess they did not have a single turnover. The Wisconsin offense just actually managed 301 yards in that
You just suck, Altmaier.
one. The run game was not very good for Illinois, which had 29 carries for 50 yards in
Was
that one.
21 of 35. Like, I wouldn't exactly be like, you're not doing your money dance out here, Luke.
I acknowledge that, but somehow
Led
Wisconsin's
their team in
quarterback,
carries, the 13 for 20.
Carter Smith, went 9 of 11 completions in that one. So a pretty dramatic change from his performance in the snow against UW. But anyways, it's no longer his
He's gonna
battle. Look, he's
find his
lost.
way. This I want. I'll never remember this bold prediction. Luke Altmyer will find his way to the Jacksonville Jaguars, and is
Oh.
going to start a game next year. I can just feel it deep in my bones. I don't know who the Jags backup is
You're going to
even, but
look up
like,
in week 14 and Luke Altmyer is going to be
yes,
starting.
no. Luke Altmyer will. I mean, we're playing Max Brosmer this coming weekend. Like,
No spoilers.
no spoilers. I like that we're announcing news on the podcast. And saved the Max Brosmer news for the end.
But All these performances by UW do make it all the more frustrating that they didn't beat Wisconsin when they had the opportunity to make this Oregon game be a momentous opportunity to get into the college football playoff. That said,
I both agree and disagree.
I do not agree that, like, oh, because of the fact that Oregon has essentially quenched a spot in the playoff and UW can't make it, that means that Saturday's game is meaningless. Because one of the things I think
If you think this game is meaningless, you cannot find meaning in life for anything. Like,
I generally
there's
agree.
there you have to care about things. And it's like, whatever, don't care.
But
But
the
I
college
can tell you
football
who
is.
does care. It's those people down south. They care about this game. They're not sitting back and being like, well, this is a meaningless game. We don't care if we win. This game matters in a lot of ways. And the reality is, what happens after doesn't actually matter that much, right? If the Huskies, like, yes, if this were a like win and go to the playoffs, it probably wouldn't even be that situation anyway. It would be
Quite
a win
plausibly
and
not.
stress about it situation. And they
Win
made,
in hope for 2 weeks.
but for those people down south, if they lose this game, they are going to be mad. And I can tell you also who they will be mad at. And it is not going to be us. It's going to be the head coach down there. And so the pressure is very much on. Like, things from the outside, this is what we've seen with a lot of coaches and programs. One loss can affect a program so greatly. And this is the type of game that if you lose to the University of Washington 2 out of the last 3 years, 3 out of the last 4 years, 4 out of the last 5 times you've played them, all of a sudden, we've got a problem. And if we lose, whatever, honestly, like the Huskies have less to lose in this game than they do, right? And it's almost because of that. Like, we could just go out there and play a fun football game.
One of the things I do want to say is, like, whatever happens on Saturday, this has been the Huskies have met expectations for the 2025 season. I know the Wisconsin loss was frustrating, but they are where are they in FPI? 19th? 20th?
I believe they are ninth. And that's why I'm a little bit less like concerned with the college football playoff conversation. Because if we are being honest with ourselves,
They are
this
not
is
one of the
not one of
12
the,
best teams in the
yeah,
country. No.
they're not. And they wouldn't go, as much as I would absolutely love to go to a college football playoff game, and they also probably wouldn't be in the territory of hosting one. I think it would be more frustrating to have won and missed out on the college football playoff than this is. And like, honestly, they might have even still put Oregon in.
Oh, I think they probably would have, yes. The other thing I want to say, though, is one of the things I don't like about the playoff is, like, for a long period of time, because of the fact that
They're 21st in FPI. And I said to you yesterday, they are exactly the 21st best team in the
you
country.
did say that, yes. Because of the fact that the college football, because of the fact that the pool of teams competing for the championship in college football is so relatively limited, there was no choice but to construct meaning from these other things. You know, rivalry games are a constructed meaning, the Northwest Championship, etc. And I do think that that is something we should not lose sight of, even in the expanded playoff era. Like, anytime you beat your rival, it matters because you have bragging rights for the next year against that team. And speaking as someone who's going to be in Oregon on Wednesday and Thursday, I just will feel better about things if I'm in Oregon
Oh,
and
you'll be
UW has
crossing over
beaten.
that bridge just so smug.
I mean, I won't know by that point. I'm just saying in the
Oh,
future.
you're going ahead of the game, not the following Wednesday and
Yes,
Thursday.
I'm driving back on Thanksgiving morning.
Wow. That sounds terrible, being in that state. Being in that state that time. I think there's this it just matters. Like, I don't even know if there are that many people actually saying that it doesn't matter, because the
I mean,
reality
not
is,
saying that it doesn't matter, but that it doesn't have the stakes that it could, which is true, but it
sure,
doesn't need those
many
stakes.
things don't have the stakes that they could. Like, was it extraordinarily fun 2 years ago to have the stakes of the Pac-12 championship game going to the college football playoff? Because that absolutely it was. But like, that's not gonna think that's gonna happen every year. And the game still matters every single year. So I and again, like I said, the game matters a lot to them also. Nobody is down there just being like, who cares? Right? Win or lose doesn't matter at all, because it does. And it matters a lot. It matters a lot for the direction of the organization, for both teams, for both programs, this game, and kind of where we're headed. So I'm freaking hyped for it. I can't wait.
Or
It's the game
Husky.
that matters the most every year.
Yeah. Husky health report, Raiden Vinesbright has been cleared to return after missing Saturday's trip to UCLA with a concussion, which left the Huskies pretty thin at receiver. Denzel Boston and Jonah Coleman expected to be more involved, Jed Fish says. Still didn't really define that in terms. And, I don't know if either of those guys are going to be 100%. Right tackle Drew Azzopardi expected to return to practice in a limited fashion on Tuesday. We'll see on that one, but it might be nice to have him available just in case. John Mills continues to do a really solid job at right tackle, changing positions midway through his freshman season and continuing to play really well. All right, Oregon. So speaking of like one program, one loss can change a program's direction. At the time, it seemed like a momentous win that Oregon won in OT at Penn State to get to number three in the country. And that started the spiral for the Nittany Lions that ended with a coaching change. Oregon then came home and lost the following week at home to Indiana. Then subsequently survived a scare at Iowa with a game-winning field goal on November 8th. Their last big game last weekend at Autzen as they comfortably beat number 16 USC to more or less clinch a spot in the CFP. But
I'm
you
not
don't
going
think
to
it was
go so.
comfortable?
It was not. I was watching much of this game, and I would not say it was comfortable.
What were your takeaways from watching that game?
USC's defense is fucking terrible. Like, it's a USC problem, and it has been that way for, I feel like, a number of years. Let me see where they rank efficiency wise.
Well, certainly 2023.
58th defensive efficiency wise. My takeaway is that if I were a USC fan, I would be very upset with the amount of talent that is available to USC as a program that they cannot put together a competent defense.
I mean, we just talked about where UW's defense has gotten to this year. USC has obviously not had that kind of defense the last 3 years.
As I'm scrolling through efficiencies, I have to get all the way to number 29. No, sorry, past North Texas. No, yeah, North Texas. Number 29 in efficiency to find a worse defense that's there, except for. That's still ahead of USC, the fucking Vanderbilt Commodores. Like, if that's the kind of conversation they are, everybody else,
My
overall
God.
efficiency wise, is better than them.
Wow,
Like,
they have really not had a good defense in a long time.
they are an exceedingly bad defense, and it's the type of defense that just that you or that Oregon in particular was going to be able to feast on. And I saw the first series and I was like, it's over. The game is over. Like, just seeing the USC tackling, they needed to have Jane Maiava had to have a superhuman type of game in this one. And I went and, well, maybe I'll talk about that in a second, but like they had two picks. Jane Maiava threw two picks. I think stats like Jane Maiava maybe a little bit more than I guess, eye test. I left that game being a little bit more unconvinced in him, but the two picks killed everything, and their defense just cannot do the things that need to be done to win against an Oregon team. That was my takeaway.
The last time that USC had as good of a defense as UW this season was 2020 when they lost to Oregon in the Pac-12 championship game during that COVID-shortened season.
Didn't we opted not to play in the Pac-12. We would have.
I mean, opted is a strong way to put it, but yes, UW would have technically won the Pac-12 North, and had it been able to play.
Okay, so what about before then, though? How far back do you have to go before that? Because to me, the 2020 season shouldn't even really be counted.
I agree, although the six games was at least a semi-representative
All right,
sample
whatever.
for
It
them.
doesn't matter about USC's defense. Their
Oh,
defense
bad in 2019, too.
that they ruled out against Oregon was not, they cannot tackle, and they're not able to make those plays on the edge. And it's the type of thing that UW has, fortunately, in these last couple of weeks, become a little bit more Big Ten, and been able to make those plays. The speed that they have defensively, the playmaking, and the tackling, it's what you need to do against Oregon, because a lot of the offense is predicated around, and I guess you'll go into the stats in a second, but a lot of the offense is predicated around making things very simple for Dante Moore. And it's a lot of running the ball. I mean, they have 3 to 4 running backs who are all pretty effective. And getting the ball out to their receivers quickly and making plays on the edge. So
I
you
mean,
have
I'd
to
say
be able to
it's
blow this up.
predicated on taking advantage of their speed. That's what their scheme is based on. Yeah.
But it's also about
You're
not
making it sound like they're
necessarily.
like compensating for Dante Moore. They were running that same scheme with Bo Nix and Dylan Gabriel, NFL starting quarterbacks.
Let
It
me give you
worked.
this look of, they sure were. They're aware of some of the limitations. Bo Nix is better than Dante Moore. Like, if we are
Yeah.
being honest with ourselves, Bo Nix is a much better quarterback than
Bo
Dante
Nix was
Moore.
doing that
But
and
also,
finishing number
just
one in
having
QBR.
being the type of being the quarterback who couldn't beat out Shedeur Sanders is not that impressive. Like, they were doing Dylan Gabriel to compensate for Dylan Gabriel.
I
And
mean, Dylan Gabriel did beat out Shedeur Sanders. He lost the
not
job due
anymore.
to injury. I guess Bo Nix was second in QBR, by the way, in 2023, though.
Bo
Some guy
Nix was
named
an
JD Daniels
actual
was number one.
good quarterback, but Dante Moore and Bo Nix are not comparable players. I'm not saying that they're necessarily doing it to compensate for Dante Moore's ability, but that is what the offense is predicated around, which is they get the ball to their receivers and they try to break tackles. And Indiana is the type of team, if you look at that game, that does not, they're fast to the ball and they make crisp tackles. And that's what you have to do against Oregon, basically.
So number six offensively in FPI efficiency, number eight on defense. Dante Moore completing 73% of his passes. Pretty much in an Oregon offense, you're going to complete over 70% for 8.6 yards per attempt. He's only number 24 in QBR. There's been some ugly games in there. He had 186 yards and two picks against Indiana, as you mentioned. 9 of 15 for 86 yards against Wisconsin in what should have been the canary in the coal mine for the Badgers defense and their effectiveness in this lost season. And then 13 of 21 for 112 yards at Iowa. On the plus side, does have four games with at least a 90 QBR, including the last two, which is as many as DeMond Williams Jr. And he's excelled at avoiding sacks, which is also kind of a function of that, get
Yes.
the ball out quick offense. As you alluded to, Oregon second among major conference teams with 229 yards per game on the ground, 6.1 yards per carry. Six-year senior Noah Whittington ranks third nationally with 7.7 yards per attempt. True freshman De'Aaron Hill Jr., even better at 8.5 yards per attempt in his limited action. So keep an eye out when he's on the field. Oregon does not have a receiver over 500 yards this season, in part because superstar freshman DeCorian Moore hasn't played since the Wisconsin game due to a knee injury in practice. Six-year senior Gary Bryant Jr. has also missed the last two games, but that obviously did not slow down their attack really at all. That has left tight end Kenyon Sadiq as the team leader in catches, yards, and touchdowns. Defensively, opponents are completing a Big 12 low 52% of their passes against Oregon. This is also kind of a trademark. Is the there's It's interesting because I feel like you do see some coaches where there's different philosophies offensively and defensively. Like what they're trying to do is not what they're trying to take away, or vice versa. Oregon, under Dan Lanning, they're going to complete a high percentage of their passes, and you are not going to complete a high percentage of your passes. 52%, the lowest in the Big Ten. Yards per completion not as dominant. You can get some bigger plays at times against this defense, and they have not had as dominant a pass rush as last season. Although a lot of that was teeing off on DeMond in the rivalry game last year, which by the way, we need to continue our work to brand this the Taco Time Cup. Or
What are they calling it now?
I don't think they're calling it. Are they calling it something?
I think we're close to getting the Cascadia Cup. I don't know, something like that. There's now going to be like logo on the field. Like this has been a properly like branded rivalry in a way that it wasn't for a long time.
I haven't heard about this. Okay, I'm going to continue researching this, but it's not the Taco Time. If it's not the Taco Time Cup and/or Bowl, whichever you think is more appropriate for Taco Time, then we're not accepting it as a name.
Fair enough. Okay.
Anyways, Mateo Uiagalelei has just five sacks after 10 and a half last year in 14 games. The third rush defense in the Big Ten at 3.1 yards per carry allowed on the ground. Unfortunately, the two teams ahead of them, or the two teams that beat UW earlier, Michigan and Ohio State, haven't allowed more than 5.3 yards per play in a game all season. Like, if this is a high scoring game, like, this is not going to be a high scoring game that the Huskies win. The defense is going to have to get stops in order to win this one, realistically.
I think that's fair. I mean, so I guess I was taking a look at Jane Maiava on the road and just trying to understand basically like what is the difference between Jane Maiava everywhere? And QBR wise, it's not that huge of a deal, but when you look at him on the road, he's played granted some very good teams. He's at 7 touchdowns and 6 interceptions for a 57% completion percentage, which a lot of that is, you know, owing to the fact that they have played Notre Dame on the road, Oregon on the road. Damon Williams also has pretty relatively similar splits, which is Damon Williams has been a much better quarterback in Seattle this year than he has been on the road. And thankfully for this game, I think we'd be talking about something different if he were in a different place. But when Damon Williams has been at the University of Washington, he's at a 76% completion percentage, 10 touchdowns, zero interceptions in this one, 5.1 yards per carry. He's been pretty much phenomenal in every single game. And the one that I think you have to come back to is actually still Ohio State, which is probably the closest to this game, and somebody who, like, Ohio State's a little bit different about how they do things than Oregon is. Their defense is better, I believe. And I think their defense is also faster than Oregon's defense is, and a little bit better at taking away the big plays. UW was leading that game farther into the game than you remember against Ohio State.
I mean, sure.
And played a game that, had they come through on a couple of red zone appearances, we're probably talking about a very different type of game. And I think the other thing is, can Damon Williams run the ball against Oregon? Can they complete enough of those passes? The offense since then has been quite good for multiple weeks in a row, and have found some other outlets in ways that they didn't necessarily have earlier in the season. And so I look at Damon Williams in a much safer environment than he has been, right? Than playing on the road, because his really brutal games have happened, obviously, at Wisconsin, the early in the game against Maryland. When he's been here, we're talking about, it's pretty much phenomenal, except for the Ohio State game, which honestly, he was 18 of 22 in. You know, like, it was a very, very good game that he played. They held him on the ground, and they just couldn't score touchdowns. And I think it really comes down to,
I don't know. I think there was a much more significant yards per play differential than you're giving it credit.
I think things also got a little out of hand late in that game as well.
Maybe things got a little out of hand late, or maybe Ohio State got unlucky early. I don't think that, you know, one of those is inherently more valuable than the other. This was not a Seahawks. This is the opposite of Seahawks Tennessee, I suppose.
Ohio
that
State
one
is
fake
also
close.
A better team than is a better team than Oregon is. But I
I agree with that, certainly.
Looking
and the
at,
other thing is, they're a Big Ten team. So, like, a lot of this is like, oh, there's, you know, UW in the Big Ten. Like, I do think there's a distinction that we have to draw between, there's actual Big Ten teams, there's Big Ten expansion teams, and then there's Pac-12 teams.
Yes.
And the Huskies against the Big Ten, traditional Big Ten teams, are 4-1 at home, 0-4 on the road. Against everyone else, they're 2-2 on the road and 3-0 at home. Like, the idea of, like, oh, they can't win on the road is almost entirely built on these games against traditional Big Ten teams and the Rutgers game. The Rutgers game is the one outlier that goes into it.
I think the other piece is, this is, the Huskies are the second best defense that Oregon will have played all year, if you can believe that.
That is kind of shocking. Iowa's behind UW?
Oh, no, sorry, the third best. Indiana and Iowa. Yes, okay. They're the third best defense that Oregon has played all year. And against those other two defenses, they got clobbered pretty good by Indiana in that game. It wasn't really particularly close in their house.
They didn't score a lot of points.
No.
I could see Oregon winning this game in a very similar fashion to the Iowa game.
Oh, you're talking about the Iowa game. I'm talking about Indiana.
I know. No, I'm saying,
They were only outgained by like 50 yards in Indiana, but yards per pass, 7 to 5.5. Like, Indiana outplayed Oregon in that game pretty comfortable. Don't forget, there was a pick six in there. It was 30-20, and there was a pick six for Oregon. So Oregon scored 13 offensive points against Indiana. In the Iowa game, it was ugly, and they ended up scoring late. There was weather that was a factor.
I mean, but this is the recipe.
They haven't played, it's strangely enough, they haven't played that many defenses this good. You know, they went at Penn State, which is a worse team than the Huskies in pretty much every capacity, offense and defense, and they went to overtime with Penn State. It's not an impressive game. They have not played.
I mean, I don't know what to make of Penn State. I think Penn State may have quit on the season after, you know, the James Franklin firing, the Drew Aller injury. Like, I don't think that their season-long stats are that meaningful for who Penn State was when Oregon played them.
Oregon has not played an impressive game all season.
I think beating USC the way they did is still pretty impressive.
It was fine. It was a fine victory. But like USC is a team that is very specifically built to lose to Oregon. Like that, it is just, and like I said, I watched the first play of the game and I was like, there's no fucking chance. That is just, they cannot tackle. They cannot tackle and they do not have speed on the edge. And so, can UW do those things? It remains to be seen against a team like Oregon, right? It is definitely different against UCLA than it is against Oregon, but there is nothing that I've seen this season that makes me think that they can't. I'm not saying that UW is going to win this game, but I'm saying they are not as prepped for this particular type of game as they may have been in the past. They don't
Okay.
have a victory like the Ohio State victory that they had last year, the first before they got beaten by them. Like they just have not done anything like that. And they honestly, they've played a pretty easy schedule overall. And the one time that they played a team that was really, really good, they got their asses kicked. So I think they are coming in. I think statistically, they look very good. And I think they're coming in very, very confident. If the Huskies can make this game about Dante Moore, the Huskies win this game. And that is really what it comes down to me, which is he threw two picks in that Indiana game. Dante Moore has not had to do almost anything this year. And if they can stop the run and if they can stop the quick passing game and not give up those extra yards and get off the field, and especially if they can get up a little bit. Like, I mean, I remember when we were there a couple of years ago and the Huskies were up and Bo Nix threw those bombs against us. And I was like, God damn, I hope they don't do that more. It was like they knew that there was an offense waiting. I want Dante Moore to be doing that. I would love to see Dante Moore throwing deep in this game because he's not that type of quarterback. And I think if the Huskies can make this about Dante Moore, get a couple of scores early, they have to finish in the red zone. And it's one of my biggest concerns, stupid penalties, which we've seen about a trillion times before, scoring in the red zone, like seeing what the fades, I'm just not impressed with the red zone offense for the Huskies. So those are the things that make me the most nervous about this game. And then I guess basically just like the stats lying to us, you know, the defense not actually being as good, Jacob Madu being out, but they're going to move the ball. Huskies are going to move the ball in this game. DeMond is going to be able to pass the ball. Whether
I'm
he's
not
able to
as
run,
confident
I
that they're
don't
going to
know.
move the ball.
I don't, and whether DeMond is able to run, you know, like how much they're going to go out of their way to try to stop DeMond Williams from running the ball. They've seen the game plan from Michigan. They've seen the game plan from Ohio State, and it works. If you can do that, it works. So the Huskies basically need to be, they need to make DeMond Williams a passer first and lull Oregon to sleep and let DeMond run after that. But the game plan can't be DeMond's running, you know, the amount of times they ran in that Wisconsin game. Like it's not going to work.
Well, that also involves receivers creating separation, and that's where having Denzel Boston, in a large rotation role, I think would make a pretty substantial difference. As well as you said at the top, that Desmond Roebuck has stepped up,
They've
and
built up a couple of these receivers a little bit since
some of the
then.
other women.
Yeah, Chris Lawson, Audrick Harris hadn't been on the field very much, and now they have. Desmond Roebuck has gotten, you know, he's been on the field quite, he was a lead, number one receiver last week as a freshman. Reign
I mean,
Vines
Desmond
Bryant should be
Roebuck's
back.
having one of the great true freshman receiving seasons in UW football history. I need to look that up at some point, but he definitely is. There's still a level to this, and against a team defense as good as Oregon, I do think you're going to want to have, Denzel Boston out there because,
No
you,
shit, you're going to want to have Denzel Boston
I
out
mean, yes,
there.
obviously you're going to have, but you could say, Oregon hasn't faced a defense, many defenses like this. You know who else hasn't faced many defenses like this?
You dumb, you're saying?
Yeah. They faced one defense all season in the FPI top 20, and it was Ohio State, and they barely scored.
Is Michigan not? Oh, wow.
They're just outside it. They're 22 or
Yeah,
21.
Michigan on the road is still like a tough defense, though, which
I agree it's a tough defense, and Wisconsin is 28, so in the same ballpark here is Michigan. But the
I mean,
Huskies didn't score a lot of points in those games either. Fun fact.
Indiana is better than the Huskies are, but like they weren't able to run the ball that well. But Elijah Surratt goes for 121 yards, you know, and in that one, they passed the ball
I mean,
pretty well. Mendoza had a
Indiana's
good
the number
game.
five. Like, UW's offense is good. It's top 20 in the country. Indiana's the number five offense in the country. There are levels to this shit.
Yeah, but I mean, Indiana was good enough to go to Oregon to win. If this game was at Oregon, we would be having a, it would be a different conversation.
I agree. I also don't know the crowd is like the travel is obviously not a big
It,
factor.
but it doesn't matter. There's just being on the road in college is a factor.
I
It is
agree.
going to, whether it's the
And
crowd,
that's,
I
I
can't
think,
exactly
why it's
pinpoint what it
close.
is.
I think that's why the line is under a touchdown. So.
I mean, all of the rivalry spreads are pretty freaking close, right? I think the Iron Bowl's like a pretty close spread too, but I'm not saying that I will be. Are we good to do percentage chances of victory?
Yes.
50-50.
Oh, buddy, you should go place a wager on the Huskies then. I don't know what the money line is, but I'm sure
Oh,
it's
I mean, I
good.
want to place a wager on the next team we're talking about, but
I think you make some compelling points in terms of the matchup being somewhat more favorable to UW than the stats would suggest. I would say 33% chance of victory. All right, well,
is
let's
that
talk about
in line with, wait, I want to look what the spread is at now. Still 6.5, or
yeah.
is 33% in line with like a 6.5 point spread?
I would have to take a look at it.
Okay. Well, the Vegas is expecting some upsets this weekend. Or they're expecting some games to be very, very close and rivalry week.
Let's see here. I would have to go back to the money line. If you got anything to fill here.
Yeah, I mean, see, even seeing the Iron Bowl spread is +6 for Auburn, like the you're doing math.
No, I gotta go 210 minus 250. I've got to run my formula here.
Oh, there's a formula.
Yeah. This one's very tricky. It is, in fact, implies 30.5%.
Wow, okay.
So, there you go.
I look forward to it as much as I mean it's I hate having all of those fans around, but like, what time are you? You're in town. Yeah, we're gonna go down there early, right?
Oh, yeah.
I want to go down there early. I want to be there for everything. I want to experience it, be around everybody. It's kind of like, I do think the Huskies are a little bit like, they're not competing for a playoff. They're competing for pride in this one, and sometimes that is the most important thing.
All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks. I just wanted to make this point quickly. That game was never actually in doubt. The Seahawks win probably never got below 93% in the second half, 97% in the final 5 minutes. And as I posted on Blue Sky, it was the second time in the NFL all season that the offense has gained at least 7.5 yards per play and the defense has held the opponent under 5 yards per play. In this case, only 4.4 for Tennessee. Like they moved it weirdly consistently, but 4.4 yards per play is a horrible offensive performance, all things
I literally
considered.
wrote down notes on this on my notepad because I saw a clip of Colin Cowherd being like, the defense took Sunday off, but they're still a good team. And I was like, how fucking dare you, Colin Cowherd, to not look any deeper than the score? Which, granted, you're Colin Cowherd. I expect nothing less, but
I mean, I know he's a Seahawks fan. He may have been watching and may have been frustrated by the fourth down
sure, I get
conversions.
that. 4.4 yards per play was the lowest in a month since the Texans game that they played. The lowest in a very long time. The 5 of 7 on fourth down. It's just like, you're going to move the ball. If you're going for 7 fourth downs, you're going to stay on the field. That's how it goes.
Anyways, it was the second time that combination has happened all season. You know what the other team to do that this season was?
Who was that?
The Seattle Seahawks against the Washington Commanders. They have done it twice. No other team has done it all season long.
That a game was closer than
No,
it
no,
should have
no.
been with those? Oh.
No, the at least 7.5 yards per play on offense, better than 5 yards, lower than 5 yards per play on
I
defense.
think they're bored. I really think that the Seahawks are
I
a
don't think
little
they're
bored.
bored. I mean, I do think they probably did miss Ty Okada to a degree in the second half.
Oh, I love that we're like, Ty Okada's not out there. Just
I
imagine
mean,
how far we've come from week one.
do you know who is out there instead? Can you name the Seahawks' other safety?
Who was playing instead of Ty Okada? Yeah, I was
Yeah.
not watching by this point. Was it somebody they drafted this year?
I don't think so.
No, I have no idea. Who?
D'Anthony Bell.
Okay, yeah, no. Definitely wasn't coming up with that one. Quandre Diggs.
Well, let's talk about that. So, Okada suffered an oblique strain Sunday, expected to miss time, unclear if he might go on IR. Mike McDonald said that's likely as a consideration with George Halani and Chaz Surratt, who also left Sunday's game. Surratt probably a hit to their special teams. I can't remember if that was before the touchdown, but Julian Love is eligible to come off IR. His return remains uncertain. And with that uncertainty at the safety situation, the Seahawks are expected to sign Quandre Diggs to
Hello.
their practice squad. Our old friend was waived by Tennessee after playing 9 games this season, including 4 starts. It's a very Pete Carroll move
Oh, yeah.
for the Seahawks. I mean, Quandre Diggs has not played in the Mike McDonald scheme, so there's not the same degree of like he can ramp up more quickly than other people as there would be if it was, scheme continuity, but still nice to like. I saw someone reply to Mike Sean, like, the Seahawks should have added safety help at the trade deadline. It's like, that's not really how the NFL works. But, like, who were they going to trade for that was better than Quandre Diggs?
That's just like, good God, people, whatever. You can't be reading those comments.
I don't try to.
Added safety. They should have known Ty Okada was going to get hurt. I do agree, though. Like, if you're looking at replacement player, like, Quandre Diggs is probably just as good as anybody they would have traded for and not had to give up a draft pick.
Exactly. All right, so let's talk about the Minnesota Vikings. JJ McCarthy entered concussion protocol after reporting symptoms on the team's flight home from Green Bay on Sunday, with Carson Wentz sidelined by surgery to repair the labrum in his throwing shoulder that leaves undrafted rookie Max Brosmer taking first team snaps this week.
Incredible. Incredible.
McCarthy is last among qualifying QBs in EPA plus CPOE composite. Nobody is even close in adjusted EPA per play, where he's more than twice as negative as Cam Ward, who's still second from the bottom after Sunday when the Seahawks defense took the week off. Ranks behind ahead of only Jamarcus
Kim Ward was
Russell.
fine. He was fine in that game.
I thought he looked pretty. I mean, he was playing against the Seahawks defense, but so I think it was very encouraging long term, some of what we saw from Cam Ward. I also don't think it was a day that was particularly conducive to his team winning the game. McCarthy ranks ahead of only Jamarcus Russell in EPA adjusted EPA per play in a qualifying single season since 2000, according to Danny Heifetz of the Ringer Fantasy Football Show. McCarthy has thrown picks on 6% of his passes, about 50% more than the next highest qualified QB, that being Tua Tagovailoa, has the second highest sack rate ahead of only Justin Fields, and has fumbled 5 times in 6 games. It's truly amazing in that context. The Vikings have gone 2-4 in McCarthy's 6 starts. They came back to win Week 1 on Monday Night Football to beat Chicago with just 254 yards offense. And then in his return from a high ankle sprain against the Lions, they won with 258 yards. But since then, they have totaled just 42 points the last 3 weeks, less than they scored against Cincinnati alone with Wentz at the controls and with 5 turnovers from the Bengals. But that's neither here nor there. So who is Max Brosmer? Question we're all asking this week. Brosmer spent 5 years at New Hampshire, sitting out 2021 due to an ACL tear before transferring to Minnesota for his final year of eligibility and starting all 12 games. He completed 66.5% of his passes as a Golden Gopher with just 6 picks, but averaged a middling 10.5 yards per completion and ranked 9th in QBR among qualifying QBs in the Big Ten last season. As you've noted, was he? Oh, I guess he was behind anything. Ethan
Nico
Garbers.
Iamaleva. Well, yeah, Ethan Garbers, he's way behind.
Yeah.
But it was just like Nico got roughed up by the Husky defense. And I was like, I would think that the Seahawk defense would probably be the best in college.
I do think it
Probably
would be.
better than number 30.
So Max Brosmer has thrown passes in an NFL game, you were
That's
noting.
right. Yeah, he's throwing passes. Plural.
Yeah. 8 of them in total. In 37-10 loss to the Chargers, mopping that up, and then the aforementioned 48-10 win over the Bengals.
Oh, God damn it. He's behind Luke Altmyer.
Oh I bet you'd love to see the Seahawks against Luke Altmyer
God,
on
I would
Sunday.
be so. I think they would probably be happy to have Luke Altmyer, to be honest. If you could just slip Brosmer for Altmyer, I bet they would make that trade. Anyway, he's no Ethan Kaliakmanis.
I kind of like Ethan Kelly. Man, it's that Booker's defense is not so strong.
Oh yeah. That would be
That
great without with a different defense. Get Ethan a different defense.
I'm just saying.
I mean, he was 52nd in the country in QBR in 2024. And when you think about that in terms of NFL quarterbacks, he's almost like not even, this is in college, granted, not even a backup as far as in terms of NFL players. I mean,
That
it's a
is
little
accurate.
bit surprising that he's, I mean, I guess he's the third string quarterback who was undrafted, but like Jalen Milroe would be so much better in this situation. You know, I'd feel so much more confident about somebody like Milroe than Max. Granted, he was third round pick, but like, I just can't even believe that we're having a Max Brosmer conversation right now.
I mean, there was last during the game Sunday when McCarthy was struggling, and it's just like getting progressively worse, it seems, each week for JJ McCarthy. And, I was like, well, how long can they keep playing McCarthy, knowing that this matchup was coming? But that was before I realized that Carson Wentz was out for the year. And like that changes the equation pretty
You're like, what's
dramatically.
Colin Kaepernick doing right now?
That's a great question. Like, I know there are
We
people
elected Zoran. I think we're ready for Kaepernick back in the NFL.
in great point.
Yeah, the crowd booed Trump in Washington. Like, come on.
Like, it's one thing. Like, I know JJ McCarthy has performed badly this season, and it was exciting the idea of the Seahawks defense getting to play against JJ McCarthy. JJ McCarthy has performed this season. Max Brosberg hasn't even gotten the chance to play this season. And his first opportunity to play any meaningful snap in the NFL is going to come against a Mike McDonald defense. I have some concerns on his behalf.
Okay, let's go back a year further, where there was a quarterback of the Seahawks also beat very badly, and Jaden Daniels, who was number one in QBR that year. JJ McCarthy was number three ahead of your god Dylan Gabriel, and Michael Penix.
I
Like,
have
which
Michael
of these
Penix, yes.
quarterbacks would scare you along the way? But like, there's a reality that I think things actually would be worse if JJ McCarthy was starting, not because JJ McCarthy is a worse quarterback than Max Brosmer. They're just not even going to let Max Brosmer do anything in this game. It's
Oh,
the, I
that
mean,
should
they're
work
going
well
to be,
because the Seahawks are the number one rush defense in the
I mean,
NFL.
it's not going to go well, but like with Brosmer, it's going to be hand the ball off, short pass. They're not going to have Max Brosmer like dropping back and throwing the ball downfield.
He's not seven-step drop.
The difference is going to be, with McCarthy, it would be interceptions, and we'd be excited about that. It would be turnovers. With Max Brosmer, it's just going to be punts.
The Vikings receiver stats tell a very sad story about JJ McCarthy and also tell an interesting story about, a lot of when the Seahawks signed Sam Darnold, one of the questions was how much was he being propped up by Kevin O'Connell and this Vikings receiving core led by Justin Jefferson? And the answer is maybe he was doing the propping up in some of these plays.
Hello, Kevin O'Connell. Wait. My
Oh
mic fell.
no.
I had to
Oh
scream it to the skies. Kevin O'Connell, retire, bitch!
let's save it until
Sam
after Sunday.
Darnold ended you. He ended you. Your career is over.
No, JJ McCarthy, yeah, did you?
Well, that too. But Sam Darnold being good in Seattle is really a like, sorry, Kev.
Justin Jefferson is catching a career low 61% of targets, down from 67% last season. For a career low 13.3 yards per reception, he was at 14.9 last year. The combination has yards per target down 2 per target from last season and his previous career average. And his total yards are down. Well, I've got 8 per game, but it's got to be way more than that. Got to double check that. Jordan Addison is catching 53% of his targets, down from 64% his first two seasons, albeit in his case with more yards per reception. TJ Hawkinson's catch percentage is way up, but
Hey,
his
always a
7.9 yards per
great
reception,
sign.
his 7.9 yards per reception are 1.7 less than any previous season for TJ Hawkins.
Listen.
I said that. Number
Okay.
three receiver Jalen Naylor has been a dangerous big play threat with 15.9 yards per reception. Probably don't need to worry about him on
The
Sunday.
ball will be nowhere near him.
Both Aaron Jones and Jordan Mason have been successful on the ground. Their 45% success rate ranks fourth in the NFL. Jones has taken over a higher share of carries lately after returning in late October.
But none of that matters.
The other reason that Sam Darnold's performance was questioned in Minnesota is because he took advantage of the fact that the Vikings were very good defensively last season amidst that 14
I
and
mean,
3.
he didn't take it, you know, he was just playing football.
Well, the regular season wins gave him credit. So people were skeptical, like, complimentary football and all that bullshit.
Okay, yeah,
The
fuck
Vikings defense has also dropped from last year. They are now 12th in EPA per play allowed on dropbacks, 19th against the rush after being top two against both of those last season. And it's interesting because the underlying stats in their pass defense aren't actually so different. Their sack rate is actually up to seventh highest under the blitz-friendly Brian Flores, who talked today to Minnesota reporters about how much how good his relationship with Sam Darnold was during their season together in Minnesota, and concluded with, "We will blitz it though."
We will blitz him though. Sure.
They have tied for the league low with three interceptions after leading the NFL with 24 last season. Our old friend Byron Murphy is part of that regression. He has yet to record a pick after last year's six helped get him to the Pro Bowl. They have forced to just two turnovers total since week three. Don't allow a lot of yards defensively. They've only allowed more than 330 twice all season. In part, that's probably some short fields because of all the turnovers, and then teams running the ball a lot because they've been leading the Vikings as much as they have.
So I was paying attention a little bit to, I think I was playing against one of their defenses in fantasy. Maybe I was playing against them. I can't remember which one. I think I was playing against the Vikings defense, and the Packers kept kicking field. Or no, I was playing the Vikings defense. The Packers kept kicking field goals, and I was like, well, it's not that many points. But of course, then the Vikings couldn't get the ball downfield after that, and we're so close to giving up a safety just so many times. Like I don't know if you were watching this on Red Zone, but it was like
No,
they
I
go
didn't
over
see
to the
any red
game and
zone.
I'm like, oh, this is going to be good. And it's like, nope. JJ McCarthy avoids a safety by an inch this time instead of a half a foot. Like it was bonkers just how bad it was. But like, I don't think this is going to be like such a blowout like some of the games that we saw a couple of weeks ago. You know, like the games where they were up 28 to 0 or something like that. It's going to be a more casual blowout for this one. Minnesota's not. I am Max Brosmer is not going to score a touchdown. It's just not happening.
I'm not ruling it out.
I wouldn't rule out that. No, this is too far. I was going to say I wouldn't rule out that the Vikings don't cross midfield, but
Okay.
there might be interceptions or things like that. But like, how about this? Max Brosmer is not going to score a touchdown on a drive that starts on the Minnesota side of the field.
I mean, that's a more reasonable take. I'm not going to rule it out, but it is a more reasonable position.
I just don't even really know. Like it would have to be a pretty big lapse of the Seahawks defense that I'm just not sure. And the safeties will matter, but not as much. It's a game and a war game. It's a Devin Witherspoon game. You know, it's a defensive line game.
It
So
is a little interesting that they're not. I mean, I get that you want to simplify things for Nicky Emmanuel, that they haven't like more strongly considered moving him to safety at this point. But
I think they're just happy with what he's doing right now. You know what I mean?
he's
Like
doing
that.
great. Well, no dispute yet.
There's no reason to mess with it, but this one just shaped up very, very nicely for the Seahawks. I do think they're going to be kicking some field goals, I guess is what I'm saying. They'll move the ball against this Vikings defense like they have against everybody else. I don't know why this would be different. And their offense is much better than the Packers also. But I think it might be another boring one for the Seahawks.
I sure hope so. Percentage chances of victory?
What is the highest number? It's so funny that ESPN
Wait,
Analytics is
hold on. What's the
69.5.
succession line? Congrats on saying the highest number. Oh, congrats on saying the biggest number, you fucking morons. That's it, yes.
That's how I feel about this game. I no, Minnesota is not an embarrassing team. Like it's probably actually some things could go wrong or whatever. It's like a 89% chance of victory. I was shocked the line didn't move. It's definitely a Vikings defense respect that the line didn't move after Brosmer. And Vegas was just like, well, the last guy sucked too, so
It
I
couldn't
actually
possibly
do
get
think
any worse.
I think that the line might the difference between Brosmer, it's just going to be total ineffectiveness rather than
You think the
hilarious
total should
ineffectiveness.
have gone down with Prosmer, even if the line doesn't change? I don't know if we see that can see that movement. Let me double check that. I'm going to say 85% chance of victory. Is the Vikings or an NFL team?
They certainly are. Whether Max Brosmer is an NFL quarterback, is a different question. Or JJ McCarthy, but there's also a little bit of like, this is a revenge game for Sam Darnold. You know, like,
Yeah, we haven't talked about that.
I think Darnold, we were freaking here. And like I said, the moment that I was convinced, and I
Well,
think
this
there are other
says
people.
they were 8.5 point favorites when it
Oh,
opened. So
okay,
the
it did
Seahawks
move.
did move up.
It might have been that by the time I looked at the line,
The total
that.
line has apparently decreased as well. So your theory
Okay.
has played out.
Yeah. There's just not going to be as much scoring. But the reason I was so convinced on Sam Darnold, and I mean, I guess I'd seen him play quite a bit. Like the stats looked good. But one of the reasons was I sat there in section 316 and watched Sam Darnold throw touchdowns against Mike McDonald's defense, a bomb to Justin Jefferson. And I was just like, this sucks. Last year, I experienced that. And now having him on the other side of the field after the season that they had and being kind of criticized at the end of last season and blamed a little bit for it, I think Sam Darnold was very aware of what people were saying about him. I think he was very aware that people were having conversations about whether Sam Darnold could do it without Kevin O'Connell. And I think you remember the retire bitch from earlier.
I do. It was a little
But
premature.
Sam Darnold right now has won that one so far, but he's going to want to do some things in this one. So I'm not concerned at all. 50-50, Luka, on the Huskies percentage chance of victory. What do you think? With that, there's no official percentage chance of victory. What do you
I
think it is?
mean, there's a lie. The implied percentage line percentage
What do you
chance of
think it
victory
is?
is, I suppose, the official.
35? I don't know what 35 plus 1 is. 65? He says 35%. He's a little bit more in line with you.
Did he say he didn't know what a percent is?
He said 33%. I said 50-50. You people have no confidence. No confidence over here.
I can't wait for Thanksgiving.
Just wait for Dante Moore to get a hold of Dakario Davis in Ephesians prize sock.
I'm not saying I want Oregon to win.
Fuck Kenyon Sadiq. That dude is getting so, people are just glazing Kenyon Sadiq all over the place. And I'm like, has anybody looked at his stats and noticed that he fucking sucks? It's like 400 yards and they're acting like he's Tyler Warren. Get the fuck out of here. Anyway, those are my unfiltered thoughts on Oregon. Dante Moore. I can't wait for him to be a bust in the NFL.
Everyone knows that, but
I don't think Dante Moore is going to go high enough to be a
everybody's like
bust.
equally talking about him.
Oh, you're unaware of this. People are like, why are Damon and Dante Moore like, why are more? And I'm like, it's 4 inches, if you want to be honest. Like the difference
I mean, I
between you.
agree with that.
Damon Williams just doesn't. If Damon
But
Williams was 4 inches taller, he would
lots of
be.
people talk about quarterback things during the season, and then the draft happens, and those quarterbacks don't go where people think they're going to go.
Drew Aller's going number one. Yeah, Prosmer didn't even get drafted.
Okay. On that note,
Somehow you could get to the place of taking JJ McCarthy fourth. I don't know how you could do that, but it happened. Anyway, thanks for
he
listening.
didn't go fourth, by the way.
What
He
did he
went
go?
10th.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, it's not that preposterous.
Yikes. Did he go ahead of 10th overall? Did he go ahead of Penix?
No, he went behind Penix, but ahead of Bo Nix.
Oh, pick up. Well, they couldn't get Roma Dunze, so.
I guess you know what I didn't mention here? You know what,
What's that?
besides the Sam Darnold revenge game, we brought him up, but you know what this game is?
What's that?
The Battle of the Byron Murphys,
Hello.
which it did happen last year as well,
Well, Byron Murphy is 1-0 against Byron Murphy.
but Byron Murphy wasn't playing as much last year as Byron Murphy is this year. Byron Murphy's coming on.
We're about to even it up, although we do like that Byron Murphy.
Of
Okay.
course, we support sort of in all other cases.
Yeah,
Byron Murphy
he's
the second, greater than Byron Murphy the first. Thanks for listening.
thanks.
Should I tack the Thanksgiving food special with Nate Duncan onto the back end of this?
Have you done that every year?
It appears I did not do it last year.
I'm fine with that. You want to hear what's on the menu for this year?
I would love to hear. This is the biggest Thanksgiving you've ever hosted, correct?
Yes, adding Lorene, Steven, Kyle, and Kyle's girlfriend.
And plus, I mean, you didn't have, you have had Grace and I both 2 years ago, but neither of us were there last year because we did Thanksgiving in LA.
You weren't there last year?
I was not, no.
I
Clearly,
did. I
so
didn't notice.
distinctly unmemorable.
No, that's interesting. I mean, it's a lot of people.
I
at this
agree.
point. So I've been, obviously, turkey. I'm going to spatchcock that fucker tomorrow. The children are really excited to help with that.
Just because they love the idea of spatchcocking?
I think they just want to say the word spatchcock.
Of course. Who among us
And
does
we
not
all.
want to? Yeah.
I mean, if it weren't for that, I'm not sure if the trend would be as big of a deal.
If we're just called, I don't know, opening up the turkey?
So I'm going to dry brine it and spatchcock it tomorrow. I got an orange to put on there for seasoning also. I'm going to season that fucker up good. I got on a TikTok of Thanksgiving preparation, which really, like, the fun part about sometimes things like TikTok is just like useful stuff occasionally.
Right.
And I will say, like, cutting a turkey, how to cut a turkey, just wait till you see it. You can just take TikTok right there. It's all China.
So it's an alternative way to carve?
Not an alternative way to carve, just like how to do it well. Which, I mean, you'll see it's sort of like the more professional way of carving a turkey, which I never knew how to do.
Okay.
I was like pretty excited.
Are you
yeah.
sure you know how to do it? Have you already cooked a turkey this November? I assume the answer is yes.
I cooked a turkey breast.
Okay.
Anyway, Kyle's girlfriend is vegan.
That is correct, yeah.
Which is funny because I feel like most of the places she goes into, like, I know she brings her own food, and that's fine. Like, I don't care if she brings her own food. I'm not saying she has to eat our food. However, there will not be an environment that she could go into that is a safer space.
A more vegan-friendly?
Than this, yes.
Because of allergy reasons, yes.
I will know where every single ingredient and every single item I will be aware of. And I also will know any cross-contamination that has happened, everything about every bit of food that has been prepared, and have the boxes for it, like all the way down to that. Because I'm like so used to, you know, like you go to like a children's birthday party and they're like, we made sure there's no nuts in here. And we're like, thanks. And it's like, of course, Luca's not going to eat this shit. You know what I mean?
It's just too risky because you don't know for sure where other
but also it's like, yeah, there's so much more to consider than people consider. And the thing is
right.
about Kyle's vegan girlfriend, I am considering all of those things.
You have already considered all of the things.
So outside of the turkey and the gravy, every single item will be vegan.
Love it.
So now you have your classic mashed potatoes. We're not going to do broth on that one because that would be not vegan.
Makes sense.
Sweet potatoes. Marshmallows, I need to check on whether they're vegan or not because I...
may depend on the variety. I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, there are marshmallows vegan. Yeah, see, because Marco can eat gelatin, which is an animal-derived protein. I'll see about that one. But gelatin is in most marshmallows. So anyway,
there are vegan specific vegan marshmallows out there that you could get.
Both types of cranberries, because you have to have whole berry and jellied of the cranberries for people's preference.
Unless you don't actually have to have either.
Oh, get out of! You need cranberries. God, I can't believe. Yeah. Tons of Rhodes rolls. I'm thinking 48. Of the Rhodes rolls.
How many total people do we have here?
14.
Okay. Yeah, it seems reasonable.
Because it's basically like a little more than three per person, and people will be eating those Rhodes rolls, right? And also, I can't just like whip up more because they have to rise for like 8 hours.
Right.
And
as opposed to the turkey where you can just whip up a little more. No, that's a joke.
Well, Jan's a little nervous about the turkey. Not, I would say Jan's not a little nervous. Jan is extraordinarily nervous.
I've never known mom to be, quote, a little nervous about anything. There's a spectrum, and there's no nervousness, and there's all the nervousness. There's not a spectrum, actually. I'm sorry. There's a binary options.
So,
and there is I'm not thinking about this, and it's the only thing I'm going to talk about for the entirety of the week leading up to Thanksgiving, although she did not bring it up when she was over at our house on Saturday.
That's good. Stuffing. I did asparagus last year, and I'm going to make brown butter carrots this year.
Oh, yeah. And, but
okay. Every single person I've mentioned that to has been like, oh, yeah, huge upgrade.
Are they?
And I'm like a little offended on the perspective from the perspective of asparagus.
Well, it isn't asparagus season, number one.
I guess that's the main thing. It's a little bit more like having a root vegetable feels better.
Number two, I would, in any context, take carrots over asparagus. And that's nothing against asparagus, but I would take carrots over them. Is it actually going to be brown butter?
I mean, I'm going to make it. Yeah. What do you mean?
But I mean, like that wouldn't be vegan. Are you using vegan butter?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Earth Balance butter is vegan. That's what we use for everything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You think I don't have a butter replacer?
I guess that makes sense, yes.
And then three pumpkin pies and maybe two apple pies and then a bunch of Sweet Lawrence cookies.
Okay.
Did I get anything in there? I feel like I covered a lot of it. Anyway.
That seems like a lot of food.
I heard about this term. Do you know the term that, because hedonism was on the front page of Wikipedia the other day. And I had to click on it.
It does raise the question why you were on the front page of Wikipedia, but I guess I'm unusual that I go directly to the search page.
I don't know how I got to the front page of Wikipedia, to be honest, but there was hedonism waiting for me. And I learned about,
I feel like there's hedonism waiting for you on a lot of places on Wikipedia, but the front page is more notable than most. Yes.
The hedonic treadmill. Are you aware of this?
The phrase sounds familiar, but I definitely could not describe it.
It's basically that. And I think about this shit all the time. It's actually nice as it relates to sports and maybe head coaches. Which is basically you just, whatever happens in your life, you just return back to your normal place of happiness.
Yeah, it makes sense. Quickly become accustomed to whatever changes in your state.
Yes. And so like, there's like a life satisfaction drawing of basically it's like you might start here and then you might go up for a little bit, but then you're going to return back, especially in terms like when we're talking years and when you get to multiple years.
This is why wealth inequality actually makes no sense from an objective standpoint, because it doesn't make people happier.
Oh, I always think about that. I mean, I guess also from head coaches are not making so much money that it's like your life can change depending on the amount of money. But I always think about that when really rich people, I'm just like, what do you want this for? Like what? I think about that with our family members sometimes when they're like, I need to get this money or whatever. And I'm like, so you could do what? You're going to buy another house? You're going to die? Who cares? Anyway, the idea of wanting to, like, if you're not going to have enough, if you don't have yacht wealth or sports team wealth, like, it kind of just doesn't matter at that point. Anyway, so you have a happiness set point. And one of the things that they said influences, which I thought was really interesting, your happiness set point is, that can influence it, is locus of control. And I was thinking about Jan in this. Because I was like, if there is any person on the face of the earth who has the most external locus of control, it is like Jan is number one. Jan does not influence anything. Things happen to Jan.
The
world
has
happens to Jan.
My worldview. It's interesting because there's a particular thing that she goes on about that we're not going to go into in this podcast, but she's very concerned with the idea that like what you're told by your parent is going to entirely shape your worldview. And does not understand that all the things that she told us for many years have caused us to operate in exactly the opposite fashion.
We've got almost no Jan worldview. Do you think that's true? Jan thinks that what you tell your...
She's on a particular... Yeah,
I think she is kind of right about that.
I mean, yeah.
It's like about what you're exposed to, though. Like what your parent exposes you to and that information. Because I will tell you, there are some perspectives that my children have that I'm like, if you were at like the average family, you would not have these perspectives.
I agree.
You know, like you wouldn't be flipping off people campaigning for certain politicians or whatever, driving down Maple Valley Highway if you were in a different family. So there are different ways of... being a person that are influenced by your parents that I see just like in the neighborhood. But I don't know how we strayed so far from Jan.
It was a Jan-related topic.
Anyway, I was thinking about the hedonic treadmill as it relates to Jan.
Yeah, I mean, she thinks that whatever inconveniences or whatever, like, she sees what other people have and is constantly like, if I had that, it would make me happy. And
that's
doesn't
the thing.
Realize that it wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because there's always going to be another person out there who's going to have more stuff than you.
For most people, you're right in the middle. Especially if you like have a big enough view of it. But if you're Jan, your perspective of where you are. I mean, I think about this with Mateo, because Mateo is very much external. He's a child. But I was like, in baseball, like, I'm constantly yelling this to Luca. I'm like, it is you. Like, that is it. Like, you are going to influence everything that happens. Like, you can't sit back and wait for other people to do things to you or whatever. Like, it is all the pressure on this thing happening. It is all you, basically.
I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing to do. Because you certainly should acknowledge the role of randomness and process over results. But I understand what
you're
saying.
But no, the process is what, that's what I'm saying. Is like, yeah. You have to influence those. Randomness does exist, but the situations that you put yourself in and get to, like, you have to be there for randomness to matter. It's not like you're going to be like not playing baseball at all and people are going to be like, and you've been drafted.
They've been telling the story a lot about Naquan Tomlin of the Cleveland Cavaliers, who did not play high school basketball and is now in the NBA. And I have a lot of follow-up questions about, like, did he choose not to play? Because he was supposedly a street ball star. Was it an academics issue? I want more information than it's on the surface level. So I'm sure it's out there.
I love for the story to just be, quote, fuck that shit.
A completely fair and reasonable response.
No notes on it. Anyway, that's Thanksgiving and the hedonic treadmill.
Will you bring it up after dinner at the table?
Oh, Luca was like, just with Larry and Steve and Kyle coming, he was like, what are some topics of conversation that would be good? And I'm like, we have to avoid all of them. Every topic of conversation. I literally am going to have a conversation with them beforehand about just like, we're keeping it neutral.
I kept it so neutral the other day. You would have been proud.
Were you around them?
No. That was
around
with Mom.
Jan?
Yeah, oh. You got to keep it neutral with her.
I think I could keep it less neutral with Jan, but
not on that topic. Just like, you know, she might say some stuff and you just got to not react with the same energy. You just got to keep it neutral, you know?
Yeah.
Not things. Like just, you know, in her being worked up about things because of her locus of control.
Yeah.
So always keeping it neutral. You know me, I am the neutral.
I listened to, this is the last thing before we have to start podcasting. I did not listen to Bold Predictions. But I was listening to, Luca was like, who is the Seattle sports figure of the year 2024? And I went back and I was like, I do not recall who I picked. I remembered who I said I was like, if I had to pick a certain person. But we had crazy ones, for what it's worth, both of us.
I don't remember.
You picked Kalen DeBoer, who won a single game in the city of Seattle on New Year's Day. Of
still
2024,
the most important figure in Seattle sports in 2024. I stand by it. We're still talking about him now.
I get it. I get why you picked him.
I am more excited about the 2025 Seattle sports figure of the year discussion.
It's over.
I mean, I will say, is there an outside chance that it could swing?
There is only one person, but that's what I was thinking. I was like, there are a lot of people who next year I think can win this. And the two people who I mentioned first were the two people who are in the mix for. I mean, it's done as far as who it is to me. There's no question who it is. But like, the other person was the other person that I mentioned. And I was like, me and Luca both fist bumped. Yeah. We fist bumped.
You both fist bumped. That's generally how it works. You can't solo fist bump.
He put out his hand. Two-handed. I put out my right hand. He put out his left hand, and then we met in the middle.
We fist bumped ourselves simultaneously.
I was shocked, though. Like, I didn't think the person who's obviously going to win it, I didn't think I would have even brought up.
That I am somewhat shocked by. I agree.
He was literally the first name that I brought up.
If the other guy sets the all-time record, we have to have a conversation.
It's just, I like that we're not saying these names as if we don't know.
We gotta. It's like
drama. Are you talking about Quade Carr here?
Poor Quade Carr is just minding his own business.
Yeah, sorry, Riken Moon. I do not think there's anything that
that's
the other player
fair.
Can do. Literally, I do not think that there's anything.
The postseason does not happen in calendar 2025. So
yes, and also like there's. I think maybe there will probably be two games after we record that podcast.
Correct.
For the Seahawks. So.
Oh, sorry. Who knows what team I'm talking about? Could be a Kraken player.
I don't even know if I can name a Kraken player.
On that note.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
And we are joined by one of the most popular Third Pelton brothers in the history of the Pelton cast, a star podcaster in his own right. You know him from the Dunked On Basketball NBA podcast. Please welcome back to the show to share his food expertise with us once again, Nate Duncan.
Well, I wasn't popular enough that Tristan actually was able to make time to go out for burgers with me the last time I was in Seattle.
You're popular as far as a podcaster goes.
Yeah, that's right. People like me much better if they don't have to actually see me in person, I think, is what I'm learning here.
No, I severely regret not being able to do that. It was one of my biggest regrets from this last summer. But I hope that, you know, the food podcasting will extend even beyond what we're going to talk about today.
Yes, that is my hope as well.
Yeah, I mean, first off, when we start doing TJ's Today or Trader Bros or Trader Joe's podcast, obviously Nate will be a frequent guest on that podcast. But that's not what we're here to discuss today. We're here to discuss the holiday that is coming later this week, and that is Thanksgiving. And the food is a crucial part of Thanksgiving, so we wanted to count down in classic Peltoncast fashion our top five Thanksgiving foods. Something we actually did on this podcast during its very first year, way back in 2013. And it was interesting to go back, and I compared, and my list has changed. So I'm curious to see whether yours has changed, Tristan.
The takes are hotter.
Meteoric growth of the podcast has changed your taste. You just truffled gravy and caviar turkey is all you have these days.
That's interesting. Those did not crack my top five.
All of mine are much more burger related now. I literally just got finished eating a Thanksgiving burger. So I'm trying to combine everything.
Do you want to give your review here? You gave it on Twitter, but do you want to give your review of that burger here on the pod?
It was excellent. I mean, I've always wanted a burger to have gravy on it, and that finally happened for me today.
Should we talk a little about Thanksgiving in general? Maybe quickly. Nate, I know when I first approached you about this, you had said you had some unorthodox Thanksgiving food takes.
Well, I guess I'm just really I'll spoil my list probably if I explain what those are. But I will say that Thanksgiving may in fact be my favorite holiday.
Yes,
that's good. Yeah, I mean, definitely from an eating perspective, it's the best.
Well, I would say from that standpoint. Also, just it's not like just deathly cold if you're in like a cold climate yet. There's some solid sports going on. And also, you get 4 full days off, which is really the only holiday where you're guaranteed to get that each year.
Right. Many people do get that break between Christmas and New Year's, but not everyone. All right. So I guess let's get into it. Nate, you're the guest. So let's start off with your number 5 Thanksgiving food.
Let's see. Number 5. I guess I would have to go with, maybe this is controversial because it's not a traditional Thanksgiving food, but macaroni and cheese.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's controversial. I don't think, have ever had mac and cheese at our Thanksgiving. So I couldn't put it on the list. But if we did have it, I'm sure it would be in my top 5.
I mean, mac and cheese is just a good food in general.
Sure. And it's just like it adds to the idea of Thanksgiving, which is just way more starch than you need. It's just like... Like every single side dish is just like this massive amount of starch. Like that's one thing that I like about Thanksgiving is like regular vegetables really are relegated to the sidelines. And it's all just like meat and starch, basically.
Pretty much. Yeah. It's you're loading up for the long winter. All right, Tristan, what did you have in your number five spot?
So I went with number five as kind of the capper to my list, which would be the capper to the Thanksgiving meal. And I went with pumpkin pie at the number five spot.
Probably like carrot cake too, don't you?
No, don't like carrot cake. But I was saying I could see a sweet potato pie here also.
Oh, spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
And the perfect way to eat a pumpkin pie or a sweet potato pie is with vanilla bean ice cream on the side.
Not on top?
Around it, in the general area.
I can't, like, this is just a general issue that I have with desserts, is that the idea of we're going to take something that on its own isn't a dessert and isn't sweet, and then we're going to put a crap load of sugar on it and put it into like a pie or a cake, and now we're going to call it a dessert. Like carrot cake, pumpkin pie, sweet potato pie, like all these things are not like actually dessert foods, and now you're just adding a bunch of sugar to make it a dessert food. Noodle kugel is like that too. You guys probably don't even know what that is, but like,
no.
But in the realm of Jewish foods, it falls into that category as well. It's basically like a sugary, like noodle based dessert. So, in general, carrot cake, of course, is like the most egregious offender in that category.
I would agree with that because, I mean, at least pumpkins, they're not like full on savory. Like they're still more in the sweet family. And I would say that's certainly true, obviously, of sweet potatoes. Carrots, them in sweet is incompatible to me. So I will not eat carrot cake.
Yeah, I mean, and anytime you can take something that's basically inedible as a raw food and put it into a pie, you have to do it.
But Nate's really not going to like my list. So in the number five spot.
Wait, I had a question for Nate first. Nate, it's Thanksgiving at the Duncan household. What are you having for dessert?
You know what? I'm so locked in on some of my favorites that I don't even really have much. You know, there'll be some pumpkin pie. Usually my uncle, who like can't cook at all, he and his wife like can't really cook at all, so they'll like go to like Baker's Square, which is, you know, a pretty like mediocre pie place, and like bring over a bunch of pies. So that'll usually be the dessert here. But I'm just not focused on dessert at Thanksgiving time. The rest of the food is just too good. The opportunity cost is just too high.
I can respect that. All right, in my number five spot, I had rolls, which I think are. I know that you're going to be upset, Tristan, but I think they're an important part of a quality Thanksgiving meal, but I think they're more something that complements the best parts of a Thanksgiving meal rather than being the best part themselves.
Is that the rolls that are kind of like they get served in like, you know, like a 9-pack, like they're all kind of stuck together and they're like yellow for some reason that you don't really understand, and and like they're served with a bunch of butter? I don't mind those rolls.
Yeah, but they're yellow.
I just want to make sure we know what we're talking
butter
about
on them.
Here. Yeah.
They're not stuck together, the ones we've had at least.
Okay, Nate, what's your number four?
I would probably go with, I'm really torn here. I think I'd go with cranberry sauce, but this is a vestige of my youth. There's still a few of those floating around. It's got to just be the incredibly crappy canned cranberry sauce with, like, you take it out of the can and you still see the ridges from the can on the side of it as it's put into the bowl. And then also, you know, this is a quick aside here, but when people scoop out from that cranberry sauce and, like, really, like, take away the can shape, like if they like they don't like, I realize you're using a spoon, but if you're not at least sort of like taking from both sides so it like continues to be in like the cylindrical shape until the end, you know, if they're just taking like, you know, a quadrant out of it, that always kind of bothered me a little bit.
It's like stepping on snow for the first time, like the first snow.
Yeah,
that's
yes,
the first
exactly
slice,
that's right,
of cranberry sauce.
Except no imitations for the canned cranberry sauce.
Yeah, can we just end fancy cranberry sauce? I mean, it begins and ends with the can in the shape of a can.
You know, I wouldn't mind the idea of like a little better tasting cranberry sauce with a little more texture, but the whole berries in there, especially because like it always seems like they don't get the stems off the berries, and there's like you'll get like stems in this fancier cranberry sauce. And not a-
okay, Tristan, you're number four.
For number four, I mean, to me, this might be a bit of a wild card, but I'm going mashed potatoes.
That is not a wild card. Because mashed potatoes is also my number four Thanksgiving food.
Okay, I thought maybe it would be higher. But to me, mashed potatoes are just a vessel for my number one item, which you can guess what it is.
Which is funny because, by the way, you had mashed potatoes number two the last time we did this.
Did I? Yeah. Wow. These last few years have been rough for me and mashed potatoes. But
mashed potatoes just outside my top five.
Honorable mention.
Yeah.
Okay, so mashed potatoes, we can all agree, have been going down in the last few years. People are out on mashed potatoes.
There's just not that much going on there.
Yeah, I want the butteriest, fluffiest mashed potatoes possible. If it's basically just regular potatoes, but they happen to be mashed, almost completely inedible at that point.
A quick aside, by the way, my father, who came to great fame the last time we did a food-related podcast, is the man who salted his fast food McDonald's hamburgers. The Hungry Man, like, mashed potato flakes, dehydrated flakes that were then mixed with, like, milk and butter, those were a staple of our childhood as well for Phil Duncan.
I don't think we ever did that. We just did probably the frozen mashed potatoes that came with the Salisbury steak and that sort of thing.
Salisbury steak, man. We never got subjected to that.
All right. Well, we shouldn't spoil a forthcoming pod. We hope to do one down the road on frozen foods.
Those mashed potatoes have defined what I look for in mashed potatoes, though. Like, frozen mashed potatoes in a little plastic tray has defined what I want in mashed potatoes for the rest of my life.
That sounds horrible.
Okay. Your number four is mashed potatoes?
Yes. I have nothing further to add here, I guess. Nate, your number three?
I would go with stuffing. And, you know, it's got to be there. I have a few stipulations, obviously. Like, there can be some bad stuffing out there.
Yes.
Like, I want it to be crispy to the extent that that's possible. Obviously, having some turkey drippings on it as well is excellent. Getting some sausage in there, especially when it's, like, really well intermingled with the rest of the stuffing. You can't have just, like, these big balls of sausage and then, you know, not good enough sausage distribution. And then too much celery, I think, has been the bane of many a stuffing.
I was going to say, stuffing doesn't reach my top five, but if I see a single piece of celery in that stuffing, I'm not eating it.
I'm with you on this. And even onions, I like onions in some contexts, but I do not want the crunch in my stuffing. I want it to be, unless it's the crunch of the baked, like, top of the stuffing, that's the only crunch I want.
Precisely.
Yeah, but it has to be like one big mealy mess. You don't want to really be able to differentiate exactly what you're eating. So I agree with you about the sausage.
Yeah, yeah. All right, your number three, Tristan.
My number three is kind of the main course. And that's turkey, and specifically dark meat turkey. White meat is fine. It's totally fine turkey. But the dark meat turkey is always the winner.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So turkey is only number three for you, huh?
Yeah. I mean, again, so much of it is just a vessel for my number one item, which kind of pulls the whole meal together. But the turkey, the white meat turkey, can be good. I feel like white meat turkey has a much higher variance, where if you can get a really good piece of white meat turkey, it probably exceeds the best dark meat turkey. But dark meat is always good, solid in every single situation. But that white meat, when it's dry, is no good.
To me, well, first off, you've just explained that white meat turkey, it's the volume shooter of the Thanksgiving meal. It's probably taking a lot of shots. It's probably too many shots because there are more misses than there are hits.
Yeah, I mean, well, so what's your Thanksgiving ritual? Do you guys go to, like, a different place every year? Is it, like, you know, certain aspects of the family will, like, host each year? Because for me, it's, like, Wednesday, my sister does her Friendsgiving. She's, like, unbelievable. She invites, like, you know, 40 people over for Wednesday night because she, like, works in the service industry, and she usually is working on actual Thanksgiving. And then my stepfather, who, like, absolutely kills it then with, like, actual Thanksgiving. So I refuse to go to any Thanksgiving that's not those two, because I know that their turkey and their number one item, which, God, we're really building the suspense for what this number one item is. No one could possibly guess what it would be. Are impeccable in both cases.
It's always been our aunt and uncle for a long period of time have hosted our family at Thanksgiving. And I don't want to disparage the turkey that our uncle is cooking. It's a good turkey, but it's just, I think, an inherent limitation of the form.
But what is Phil Duncan doing on Thanksgiving?
He's going to be going to my sister's Friendsgiving. And then I think he's doing something with my stepsister
he's got some mashed potato flakes.
Yeah, no, it's funny, though, like, I mean, because, like, my sister and I are just, like, these massive foodies now. I mean, she's like for real. She actually like works in the industry. Like she's like a level beyond me on both appreciating food and drink. You know, I'm more of like a master of the plebeian foods, as we've discussed on previous podcasts. But you know, he just like he'll go to these things with us, but he just doesn't like appreciate it as much. Like food is just like not as important to him, I think, as you know it is for some of us, some others of us in the family.
Do you feel like this is a major aside, but do you feel like that's a generational thing? Because for us, like the young people in our family, all we care about is eating the best possible food. And it feels like the older generation, the like baby boom generation, just wants to eat large quantities for as cheap as possible.
Yeah, maybe. Although, I mean, like my stepfather is certainly like quite the gourmet or the gourmand. I don't know what the difference between a gourmet and a gourmand is. But you know, I think it's fair. They're definitely for our age and certainly the people that we hang out with, you know, nearly everyone that I know is like very interested in discussing food, whereas, you know, it's much more hit or miss in the older generation.
Yeah, it would be weird to me if I had a friend who wasn't that interested in discussing food.
Yeah, because you'd have to talk to them about basketball, and if they weren't interested in basketball, then you would have
exactly.
nothing to discuss with
exactly.
them at all.
The conversation would be over at that point. maybe football, if we're stretching. Yeah, all right, yeah. My number three here was sweet potato pie, which somehow did not make my list 4 years ago when we did this. Apparently, I had not eaten sufficient sweet potato pie at this point. But my aside here is that it turns out that the best sweet potato pie is actually now being made by McDonald's. Tristan, I thought you were going to jump in to back me up here because you also have had...
You know, first off, they have pumpkin
pies. Oh, that's pumpkin
pie.
Pies?
That's not sweet potato pie.
Oh.
Yes. Second off, you did not see...
Imagine not pie. Being able to tell what an ingredient was at McDonald's.
The distinct flavor palettes.
You're going to have to edit that out completely. Just that was never spoken. Me and Nate will never relay that to anybody else.
No, I think I'm leaving it in. I think it's good. The best pies.
I have nothing to add there.
McDonald's. But no, sweet potato pie over pumpkin pie. It's a solid favorite there in that matchup. I know I'm alone here.
Okay. No, I don't think you're wrong about that. I think sweet potato pie is kind of like maybe like a hipster pie. I feel like sweet potato pie is one of the coolest pies there are right now.
I usually hate having hipster food takes.
Pumpkin pie is the older generation's pie.
All right, I've already made my derisive opinion known on those foods, so I'll just take it to my number two, I guess. That would be the turkey. I'm more of a white meat person, again, just because the people who cook my white meat turkey do an impeccable job. It's always awesome. To the point where it's even awesome as leftovers as well. I mean, that's one of the bigger reasons that I like it. I think it as like a sandwich, especially like if you take like a little like a French bread, put some turkey on there, and then you just slather it in our as yet unnamed number one Thanksgiving food. It really is outstanding. So turkey, I mean, that probably turkey plus number one, I would say encompasses 75% of my consumption at Thanksgiving.
Interesting.
Wow.
All right, Tristan, you're number two.
For number two, I went with biscuits/rolls, basically the bread that you're making your Thanksgiving sandwich out of. Because the number one way to eat Thanksgiving dinner is to take all of it and put it into a sandwich. Every single item that you have there. Today I had that same thing, except with a burger patty on there too.
And cranberry.
Every single thing you're having at Thanksgiving, and you smash it all together as high as possible, and you make that into a sandwich. And the roll is, you know, it's holding it all together. If you have a soft, fluffy, buttery roll, it can make that the best meal that you're having all year.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is more of like the biscuit to me is the more of the role player in this equation. So that's what, or I'm sorry, the role. Yeah, it was, the role was the role player. Oh, I didn't even put that together until now. So I don't have it rated quite as highly, even though I agree it's an important part of a winning team. My number two.
What is your number two then?
Since I'm the only person to mention these at all, sweet potatoes, and more specifically, a gif of Vernon Davis saying sweet potato candy yams is actually my number two. I mean, I like eating sweet potatoes on their own. My typical fall like side dish will be to just do a baked sweet potato and eat that, since it's pretty simple and pretty tasty. And when you then add marshmallows and brown sugar on top of that, I mean, it's delicious. That could be the dessert. I would be fine with that.
Should we talk about gravy now?
Yeah, let's get to it. We've been waiting this whole time. The consensus
number one.
Yeah, it's my stepfather, he makes like double the amount of gravy just for me. Like I would say that my plate, there's no like, first of all, like whatever plate I'm using has to have like some sort of an edge. We used to have these great like brown plates that had almost like an inch edge on the side, and that edge was all the way like over at the edge. It wasn't like, okay, there's like a middle portion and then there's an edge on that, and then there's this superfluous like edge to the plate that's decorative but doesn't actually like have any room for your food. Now these plates were amazing. We've kind of gone away from that in recent years, but nonetheless, like I have every inch of my plate that isn't covered by a food item is covered with gravy. And I get so much gravy in each bite. I make sure that each bite of turkey is completely soaked in gravy. Each bite of mashed potatoes is, each bite of stuffing often as well, that even so with that much gravy, there's no gravy left on the plate by the time I have finished that plate. It is my absolute favorite. But the caveat is you got to have great gravy, because bad gravy can just ruin your entire Thanksgiving. And that of course is why I'm so fastidious about where I have my Thanksgiving.
That's true. Tristan, do you?
Easily number one. I mean, not even a competitor to gravy on the Thanksgiving meal. I mean, basically, gravy is number one, two, three, four, and five, especially because when you're making the gravy out of the drippings from the turkey, which is how gravy should be made, you have so much turkey in there already. It's like when I'm making gravy from those drippings, I'll pull off a bunch of little pieces from the turkey, the moistest pieces, mix them all around so that if you wanted to, you could scoop some mashed potatoes, do the little hole in the middle with the gravy, and that could even be your turkey. You don't need large pieces of turkey. You can have it floating around in your gravy, and it is excellent.
Like, I remember there was one time, this is my previous girl that I dated. This is really probably the beginning of the end of our relationship. Like, we were at her place. They went for like a deep fried turkey. Actually, what they did was they let's buy the deep fryer, like cook the turkey in it, and then like try to return it afterwards.
Oh my God.
but so like her grandmother didn't really like speak much English. And so she would just like kind of do stuff, and there was just like there was like no way to stop her. You know, like at one point, apparently she just like hid like $5,000 in cash like somewhere in the house, and like no one knew where it was, and they just like never found it again. But in any event, we were like all set to like make the turkey gravy out of like, you know, the turkey neck and the gizzard and all that. And then like all of a sudden it disappeared. And then like it came out. We were like, what are we going to do? We have to like make turkey, like make gravy with like no turkey. Like the turkey is in the deep fryer. So like you can't really make it out of the turkey. When it's being deep fried, you have to like take out part of the turkey to make the gravy. And then like it came out as like some soup later that like her grandmother just made, and like no one knew what she was doing. And it was not a holly jolly Thanksgiving that year.
Wow. She ruined Thanksgiving. Oh, man. I'm assuming, Kevin, this is your number one also. Have you confirmed this?
It is my number one also. Yeah, it's the consensus number one for sure. I mean, yeah, gravy is the key reason why Thanksgiving is such a good food holiday, because in no other situation is gravy as prominently featured as on Thanksgiving.
So I was talking with my coworkers about this, our top five Thanksgiving items, and I was like, clearly gravy is number one, but one of them argued that gravy shouldn't even count as an item because you're having all of the other things with gravy. It's not like you eat gravy completely on its own, although you could.
Only decorum prevents us from doing so.
But do we feel like it definitely counts as its own Thanksgiving food item?
Yeah, why not? It's like the defining thing that has, I mean, like what else? Like without it, the meal would be nothing.
I mean, I guess you could say like mashed potatoes with gravy would be like a higher one. But yeah, I still think you got to count it separately, because if theoretically it were removed, everything else would fall apart.
This podcast is getting way too pedantic for me. This is just not the sort of thing I'm into. Yeah,
without gravy, there's no potatoes. There's no turkey. There's no pilgrims. There's no Charlie Brown. Thanksgiving does not exist without the gravy.
I mean, is this what this podcast is? It's just you guys like obsessing about the minutiae of food like over and over again, and like categorizing things. I mean, it's just like people don't get bored of that. Like, you know, that's just it's just not my thing at all. Like, I don't know why you invite me on this show.
Well, thank you so much for bearing with it. I know this has been a difficult 25 minutes for you, Dave.
It's been a struggle for me, I have to say. I mean, I couldn't even come up with anything to say, honestly. Like, you guys are just like, it's so mundane. God.
Please don't
don't write the iTunes reviews for people, man. Come on. All right. On that note, thanks so much for taking the time, Nate. Thanks for listening, and a happy Thanksgiving to everyone.